All right, welcome to Radio Astina. I'm your host, Alex P. Linder. And we're going to talk about a number of different things today. First, my apology for starting late. I never seem to know. Lately, I've been more of a winter schedule, up all night, and asleep causing me to rise a little bit later in the day. Today, what we want to talk about our pièce de résistance, our main piece, our feature, if you will. A feature, if you will be the story of Catholics wimping out and acceding to a single Jewish phone call in canceling a lecture series that was to be held at the Catholic University of America, featuring E. Michael Jones of Culture Wars, who's certainly famous in these parts, as we've dissected many of his articles, gone over them for the historical truth they contain, as well as the Catholic dogma, which we successfully refuted. Now, before getting to that, I want to talk about a number of different things. We'll probably run about 3 hours today, probably from about 3:30 to 6:30 here. It's about 3:20 right now. This is more or less around our 30th show. I'm not sure which number precisely. I have not updated the archive. Of course, if you go to govnn.com, you can find all of these shows. They appear every Tuesday, usually at 1 p.m. Central, run for about 3 hours. Sometimes they go all night, like last week, or they start a little bit later, but they're always on Tuesday until we expand or change days. But we've done these 10, 12 weeks in a row now, so we have a good, healthy archive of MP3s that you can download, copy onto discs, pass them around to your friend. What we offer is news without Jews, commentary without Jews. There is no Jew between me and you, as one of our guys likes to say. And that's the way to look at it. Everything else you hear from the media today, other than my voice, will have been edited, filtered, and tied to an agenda by a Jew. You know, that kindergarten teacher-eyed person on TV, no, they're not a Jew. They might not seem to be pushing a Jewish agenda, but who's the producer? Who's the station manager? Who's the owner of that TV station? Which chain does that station belong to? You trace the higher-ups, the editors, the higher producers, the story editors, the people in New York, the top of the chain of newspapers or television stations or radio stations, and you're going to find Jews in New York, usually, or else Jews in Hollywood, or Jews in New York using content produced by Jewish production companies out of California. And that's how all the mass media works, and that's why it seems so uniform. And since the average Aryan, and Aryan is nothing but a fancy word for white person, accepts what he sees at face value, he is going to swallow what people who are not like him and who are in fact at war with him want him to believe without ever questioning it. This will push him down the right path. As they say in the Protocols of Zion, overtly in the public schools, they are going to promulgate doctrines they know to be false. Doctrines they know to be destructive of the morals and clear thinking of the young charges of their goyish enemy. Question everything that you hear. Trace the source of what you hear. Ask what agenda is being pursued. It's not difficult to discover it. It's not like this stuff can truly be hidden. It's maybe 3-4 inches under the surface and a couple good shovel digs and you're upon it. You've got it. But most people are not even willing to go that far. So they accept what comes in. They believe it. It seems real to them. They can't imagine that someone could have a malign motive for spreading this garbage. They don't realize how much is covered up. They don't realize this diversity garbage is not happy and helpful and wonderful. It's destructive and genocidal and dangerous. And I see these lemmings running off the cliff joyously, They're going to vote for Obama. He's going to solve all of our problems. Just like we see on TV where the wise elderly Negro FBI agent working with a blonde woman solved the problem, which means cherchez le white male, who's always the root of the problem, whether he's a serial killer, a pedophile, an evil corporate executive, a deadbeat dad, a preacher, a fundamentalist, an anti-abortionist. Whoever the bad guy is, it's always going to be a white male. You know that from watching TV. Now, what we're going to talk about today are a number of different things. First, we're going to talk a little about sports and race. Then we're going to talk about an agitprop term or two, a couple of different ideas, a little bit about the election. But the mainstay of what we're going to talk about is the canceled lecture series written about by E. Michael Jones in an article in Culture Wars, April of this year, 2008. And if we have any time after that, we'll talk a little about what I've been reading lately. Alfred Rosenberg, whose work, The Myth of the 20th Century, places him perhaps second only to Adolf Hitler in being a Nazi philosopher, or at least theorizer. And what Rosenberg tried to do, essentially, was to strip the Jewish elements from Christianity and restore the Nordic elements. Now, it's entirely possible to argue that's not possible to do, that Christianity is inherently Jewish. It all kind of turns on what you believe about Jesus, whether he was a Jew or not, or whether he was a Jew unlike other Jews, or whether he was purely of God, or whether he was actually a Nordic himself, an Aryan Galilean, in sort of an outcropping of Gentiles among the Jews. Either way, it results to favoring these values over those, and then trying to claim for the values you favor the true authentic history of Jesus. Now, I don't get into that stuff. It's interesting to me in that it interests so many others. To me, it's rather ludicrous. You choose the values you favor, whether they come from your racial soul or you choose them externally. You admire something that maybe isn't in you, and you go with it. It doesn't matter. It's kind of a silly game to try to spot it in Jesus and claim he was really this way or that when it seems pretty hard to know the truth. But since this kind of dispute has engaged the minds of intelligent men for a couple of thousand years, there's a lot of history there, and these men had a lot of effect on our European civilization. And a lot of this still plays in today when we turn to the Catholics for their intelligent history, as E. Michael Jones provides, and they're being involved in being attacked by the same people we are. In no way does the fact that a man is attacked using the same terms and by the same people that we white nationalists are, in no way does that mean that he is on our side. Jones would specifically renounce white nationalism and would attack Nazism. And in fact, Rosenberg's book, this is something I had not realized or had forgotten until I reread it. Rosenberg's book, The Myth of the 20th Century, was the subject of a papal encyclical, an attack. And the attack was written in the vernacular. That is, it wasn't put out in Latin. It was actually put out in German and the different vernacular languages. Mit brennender Sorge, with burning sorrow. And it was a deliberate attack on Alfred Rosenberg's philosophy. The church was scared by what he had to say, and they didn't want any Catholics in Germany going along with it, because what they want is their Roman, Italian, Oriental, Jewish, Levantine, Asian philosophy of submission to authority and docility and turning the other cheek. They want that to prevail over Rosenberg. And despite his name, he was not a Jew. He was a Protestant from Tallinn. What today is Tallinn, Estonia, used to be called Reval, I believe. And he was the only Nazi who was not a soldier, and who saw the Russian Revolution close up before he went to Germany. He was part of the Germans who were way over in the east. And his life's goal was to Nordicize Christianity, and he supported the value of a strong, dominant, assertive, proud Aryan Nordic white man, German specifically, and Jesus. And so the main example he used of Jesus being a true Nordic was his cashiering, his driving of the money changers out of the temple. Now, from my point of view, you can pick and choose what you want from Jesus, and that's basically what they all do. But the key here is that the Catholic Church was very concerned for their universalist doctrine of submission to authority and obedience. And counterposed to this is Rosenberg's view of Jesus as dominant, proud. Pride is a lot of this. Pride is a good thing to the Arian in Rosenberg's writing. Pride is a bad thing to the Catholic and the popes. There's also the view among Rosenberg's crowd, which is that if you've got God inside of you, you know what your honor and your duty are. You know right from wrong, and you can follow it. You don't need these super stipulated Jewish codes drawn out at great length, whether it's 10 commandments for the Goyim or 640 commandments, as they're said to be, for the Jews. The Jews need that very strict code in which totalitarian rabbis dictate the jot and tittle, the last detail of everyday life, because they don't have any honor within them. They lack that instinctive recognition of honor, duty, and nobility that the Arian has. So they need all the endless, endless codes and disputes and whinings and what am I allowed to do and when am I allowed to do it. They need all that. We don't need that. We Arians instinctively know what is good and right, and we know that when we stray from that, we feel bad. And so Rosenberg's view is that Christianity was correct in its primitive years in relation to Jesus and the original Christians, and it was getting away from the Jews, and to restore it as a mechanism of control, as something that would serve them, they sent Paul. Except his name wasn't originally Paul, it was Saul. And of course, you may have met Sauls in your life, and you probably never met a Saul who wasn't a Jew. So Saul had a conversion on the road to Damascus. And, you know, he's struck down by a bolt of light and he becomes a Christian. And then he goes out and becomes a very famous Christian, writes letters to different groups of people. And the argument of Rosenberg is that he essentially Judaized Christian and brought all the Judaic codes and focus on rites and rituals, as opposed to leaving it as an inward religion, an inward knowledge of God, and something in which the rites and the rituals and all of that were simply not as important. I mean, if you think of Jesus and how he acted, he didn't go through all the rigmarole that the churches do. He would dine with prostitutes, et cetera, et cetera. He didn't have some set way of doing things the way that Peter and Paul and the church did. So, a lot of disagreement there. But what we're trying to do here over the course of these shows is to show you why the white nationalist way that we have is better than what the Catholics and the Christians have, and certainly much, much better than what the Jews have in store. And we do this by a close reading of different texts, valued as we find them. But first, like I said, I wanted to talk just a little bit about sports. I've seen a couple of things in recent days that were interesting in betraying the Jewish mindset, and I think we can talk about with some profit, but we're going to go over them fairly quickly. There's just so much good stuff, and it seems like there's so little time sometimes. And the drab winter months set in here. Well, let me see. And I played a lot of music coming in. I had to do some errands and be on the road for a bit there. We have a fairly nice fall day here. I've been out walking around and looking at things. There's actually, Kirksville is kind of a lower middle class community in northeastern Missouri from which I'm broadcasting today. This would be October 28th, year of our Lord, 2008. And I always say year of our Lord, 2008, just because the Jews hate Jesus. Doesn't mean I like Jesus, but if they hate him, he can't be all bad, can he? And maybe some of you don't know this, but the Jews are the ones who have really pushed getting rid of B.C. and A.D. and changing it to before Common Era and after. The Jews want to erase any mention of Christianity. In fact, they'd like to erase the religion as a whole, even though at the same time they subvert it. They subvert it while they're trying to eliminate it, if that makes any sense to you. Hey, maybe we can't eliminate it overnight, but on the other hand, we can weaken its liturgy. We can, through Nostra Aetate, we can change its position on the Jews. We can render it pliable, make it good for us, make it serve our agenda. And as an example, in an article Jones has we won't talk about today, but it's in Culture Wars, and you can find ordering information at culturewars.com. It's a free unpaid plug. I mean, Jones would disassociate himself from VNN, certainly, while nevertheless, because of the good history he puts forward, we like to talk about him. But one of the articles that appeared in the last within the last year in Culture Wars was about how Jews have subverted the official organization for providing Catholic schools with published material. So not only do Jews have their noses in the Department of Education that determines what your child is going to be taught in a public school, they've also seen to it that their false views, the lies about the imaginary atrocities they've suffered, are inserted into Catholic educational materials as well. Think about that. I don't know what it is about white people that makes them open to subversion. They simply don't seem to be able, as a group, to perceive often enough, let alone fight back against those who are out to harm them. And when you've got whatever the biology is that makes that more common than not, this openness to invasion, maybe it's just openness to new ideas, maybe it's the same thing. I don't know what the biological root of it is, but it's biological, there's no doubt. But when that biological base is built on with this culture of turn the other cheek, be humble, be obedient to authority, why you get to a situation where it's well nigh impossible to perceive threats directed against your corporate community. Whites really seem to be embracing their destruction if the number of Biden signs I've seen about town are to be believed. And there's some very large ones. I would say it's 3-1, Biden over McCain. McCain, of course, is equally a tool as Obama is. I'm sorry, I said Biden. I should have said Obama signs, Obama-Biden signs. McCain is equally a tool as Obama, but the symbolic value is significantly different. The founders of the country would have ripped their hair out at the idea of a nigger having any political rights, let alone being elected president over whites, because they know what niggers are like. And someone made a very good point at VNNforum.com, which is my forum, VNN's forum, I encourage you to join, that we are on the verge of having a nigger who admits in his own autobiography that he hates whites. Now, he says for political reasons, obviously his view has changed, but there's no reason to believe that whatsoever. A nigger who hates whites, married to a black woman whose whole career has been based on affirmative action, as his own has, and who is intellectually deficient, hence needs affirmative action, not just for loans, but to pass the admissions requirements. These two are going to be in a White House having access to the nuclear football, and they hate our race. Are we preparing the way for the world's first drive-by nuking? I mean, lots of claims are advanced on behalf of niggers, in relation to their inventing something, but really the drive-by is pretty much the only thing they've invented. They invent new ways of using white technology to kill people, and that's about it. Of course, being niggers, they're not even good at that. Most of the time, their drive-bys, they shoot a bystander because they have to flip their hands over like they've seen coons in the movie do to be really cool. And so as the white man sits back and allows the Jew to subvert his religion and preach to him genocidal lies over the mass media, he glories in how progressive he is as he takes that next step and elects a nigger president. Yes, a Marxist mulatto is going to solve all of our ills. If by solve you mean exacerbate. You know, if you're on the edge of a cliff and your next step is off the cliff, I don't think it's a good idea to be a progressive. But as I said, most people don't think. Most people can't think. Most people cannot think beyond a very rough instrumental level. Most people cannot think beyond the level of, what do I need to do to procure myself a sandwich to keep myself alive for the next 4 hours? I know. I will go in the kitchen. I will scout some bread. I will scout some bologna. I will scout a piece of cheese. I will slap them together and I will consume it. Yea, verily will I be fortified that I might perdure the next few 60-minute segments of the biological space I'm enjoying at the behest of God. Now, it's not merely that white people are taught the wrong things. It's that their very mechanism they might use for associational, deductive, and genuine intellectual thinking, these mechanisms are disabled deliberately by the public school system whose agenda is set up and fostered by Jews. Paranoid, paranoid, paranoid. Oh, you don't know what's going on. No, you don't understand. When you're a tiny, sick minority whose interests are at odds with 98% of the people, as the Jews are, or as the homosexuals are, you have to control the media, you have to control the politics, and you have to centralize everything. Otherwise, it's all going to escape your control. But when you do achieve the great task of centralizing all of the power, the money, and the media, why, the benefits you can reap are unending and monstrously huge. And I tell you, if you don't think they've centralized this, there may be different textbooks used, but you're not going to find one textbook in use in any public school in the land in which whites are celebrated as a wonderful, great race that has brought nearly all the good in the world, all the material, spiritual, and other good in the world, to everyone else. And that everyone else eats freely of their civilizational achievements as usufruct. We figured out how to grow the trees that make the apples that they are eating when they fall on their ground. We instead are portrayed as the bad guys. And this is the rule: wherever Jews take power, reality is flipped on its head. The host becomes the bad guys. The host is perpetrating. He's not someone who is graciously allowing the Jews into his universities, allowing the Jew to have equal political rights, allowing the Jew to get rich by networking and cheating others. He's this evil host who is constantly exhibiting anti-Semitism and discriminating against the Jew and hating the Jew and not giving him his due respect, and not paying him tribute for the imaginary atrocities he suffered. They get the partying, we get the bills. We get the lies and they get the fun and the power. We are the bad guys, they are the good guys. That's how they put it in their media. Anyone who even uses the word Jew today is called a hater. You're not to look at them, you're not to think about them. You're not to ask about what they're doing and why. You're just to do whatever they tell you. Whatever, however they define you, you're to accept that. And if you reject that scheme of things, then you become a hater. And as a major politician in one of their controlled parties said, you know where the exits are. That's Bob Dole, tough guy. Driving out anyone who might be pro-white or actually try to achieve some political representation for whites, as though they were a real community with interests in protecting itself and the families that make it up. The exits are clearly marked. Only those who love other cultures and hate their own are approved. Only those who vote for billions of dollars of aid for Israel can call themselves Republican or Democrat. Only those who love sex deviants more than normal married couples can be Republicans or Democrats. It goes on and on. In every area of life, they support the diseased and abnormal over the normal. Someone writes me and says, why whites want Obama, in my opinion, is not about what Obama can do, but to show what whites can do, how noble we are, how big of us. The golden rule. Okay, yeah, that is certainly a large element of it, and it's fed by the media, because the media is forever portraying it as some noble, progressive step. And what's missing... And what's missing in America, and you know, I was thinking about this last night, is it the fact that I'm somewhat ill and a little older and more jaded? I don't find anybody out there writing the kind of stuff. When I was young, I used to enjoy paroxysms of joy, kind of intellectual orgasms, when I would read different writers and I would see, oh, that's so marvelous, the way that person put that. It would just leave me ecstatic. When I would see how P.J. O'Rourke wrote, I would go, that is the best goddamn thing in the world. That's just, it's awesome. And, you know, that's what, I knew I could do a little of that myself, you know, and but that's what really I loved and what just, and I can't find anybody like that now. And I want to know, is it me? Or is that stuff just not out there? Or is it just that we're that much more Semitically correct than we used to be? And truly, people are afraid to speak freely in America today. That's the truth of the matter. And it will likely get worse under Obama. It's hard to see him do anything other than sign off on this ADL-promulgated anti-hate legislation that will effectively outlaw radio presentations like this one, in which I speak to you the truth about what the Jews are doing and what they are using blacks to do to whites. And yeah, this blowing smoke up white asses is big business. Take something like Time Magazine. It's perfectly calibrated as though it were laid out like a menu created by a dietitian. And you need to have this diet, and they'll serve you basically two-thirds liberal and just enough meat, beef, protein, right-wing reality to make it plausible to describe Time as a news magazine rather than an overtly Judeo-leftist, multiculturalist junk media. And it's perfectly calibrated. The letter section in which people write are perfectly chosen. It's almost as though they're pre-written, like some kind of porn magazine. letters to Penthouse or something. They're perfectly written, perfect length. They express the idea that the liberals want perfectly in the perfect percentage to show you that, yeah, there's still people out there who aren't totally down with the liberal agenda. You'll have two people pushing the liberal agenda that they're trying to get across, and you'll have one demurring, but demurring in a liberal way, to say, oh, it's not really quite that bad. And the person, oh, okay, we can accept. But even if you accept the demur itself still has the embodied assumptions that the liberal letters do. We aren't really that racist as you say, you know, blah, blah, blah. We've learned to look beyond race. And what we lack in America, and really, you know, I used to work at a convenience store called Heinz in the East for a few weeks while I was an unpaid intern, and I learned a few things that I hadn't known growing up. Although I had worked, I had never worked as a cashier or anything. I learned that people who buy cigarettes buy them all the time, and they like Marlboro Soft Light, Marlboro Light Soft Pack. That's one thing I learned. And they spend a lot of money on cigarettes. I also learned that sometimes niggers will try to shortchange you, and you have to be careful. And what else did I learn? I forgot an approximate lesson I was going for that relates to this. Damn it. Well, perhaps it will recur to me. Nevertheless, reading Time about Obama, I mean, you see very clearly it's essentially silly liberal female writers who never really write about anything other than race, sex, whatever, and always along predictable lines and never brilliantly. We just don't... Oh, that's what it was. One of the guys I worked with in the brief time I worked there, he quit to go to clown college, and I can't help but feeling the entire country has become a clown college. I just... Palin is really a good representative of that, this rah-rah, everybody's a cheerleader, we must always be happy and be grinning, and we always want to be included, and we don't dare ever stick out. There just aren't many Americans who have a genuine personality. It's the land of the rictus, the land of the fake smile. And I'm not saying that it's wholly bad, it's just... I don't want to get off in one of those anti-suburban rants that you see from all the leftist writers, because those are wrong in their own way. We just don't really produce distinct people in this country. It's kind of like we've all been shot through, like most of the meat these days is with 25% saltwater solution to artificially bulk up the weight. You never see anybody who has a clear and distinct way of taking the world anymore. Or very, very rarely. You don't see anybody who's bent on his own personal idea of what should be created and what could be accomplished. And if you do, it's usually false. It's usually something that's subsidized by government. And no real art, no real literature is ever going to be underwritten by a crap state like we have. You know, it's one thing for some Italian genius to be underwritten by the founding family of the city, the De' Medicis, or one of the other, I can't even think of their names, the rulers of the different little Italian city-states. That's one thing, if they're commissioning you to make a church door or a triptych or some giant painting, or commission some painting of themselves. That's something else entirely. But the stuff that's founded, that's furnished by government today or underwritten by government is universally crappy. And those are the only people who, as I say, they appear on the outside to have distinct individual lives and ways of looking at the world, but really they don't. It's just like they're subsidizing white niggers. Niggers are useless. The government extracts trillions of dollars, literally trillions of dollars from whites to essentially buy more niggers. Because really, what do niggers do besides smoke pot, play video games, commit drive-bys, go into club, and reproduce? They really don't do anything. So we're paying them to create more niggers. Thanks to our allowing the Jew to take over our government. And it's the same thing with so much of the other spending that we do. It's always going to some edgy painter or writer or whatever if it's filtered through the government. Yet what do they produce? Nothing worthwhile. Nothing substantial. Just public art that everybody hates. Architecture that people can't stand. We'll have to talk about that. Jones has a whole book on that. And like everything else, of course, he traces bad modern architecture to sexual immorality and political ideology to some extent. Mencken said that we had a libido for the ugly in America. And he talked about how ugly the different architecture was and how Americans really seem to love that. I'd just say America's become more flavorless and bland. To me, it seemed for a long time, and this is sort of the American version of the Soviet tyranny, where you have to live a double life. You might have your private feelings at home and your other feelings for the public square, and you don't dare express what you really think. In the Soviet Union, everybody would be stone-faced and gray. But here, it's a happier version of the same thing. You always have to be smiling and never insult anybody and never ever say what you really think and always act like you're a Hollywood movie star on the red carpet and make your tepid little jokes and grin, oh, did I dare say that? About really mild stuff. And use stupid adjectives like edgy. You know what? I was going to discuss a different propaganda term, and maybe we'll get to that later, but let's talk about edgy first of all. This is an important concept. When understanding what drives the U.S., nearly everything is turned on its head, because if my thesis is correct that the U.S. is controlled by a tiny, hostile, alien, parasitic, predatory minority, and it is correct, and this minority is essentially 2% of the country. Jews are kind of like race homosexuals. I mean, homosexuals are maybe 1% to 2% of the country. They're not any 9 or 10%. And they can only have power, they can only enforce their ways if they control the way that we think and perceive things. So they need political power. You get political power by having money and by having media. The Jews have those. And thus other tiny hated minorities fellow travel with them because of the synergy. They can kind of pull each other up by their own bootstraps. And so it is with other tiny, sick minorities, some of them which may be bigger than 2%. Angry women might be, might be 15%. The point is they have to build a block large enough to combat the normals. So you take Jews and you lump in queers, you lump in angry women, you lump in illegal aliens. Pretty soon you've got 40-50% of the country, and if you keep going, you get to a point where nobody who isn't promoting your agenda, whether in sharp cheddar form or mild cheddar form, is able to be elected. So like the Democrats are the sharp cheddar, the Republicans are the mild cheddar, but they're all Jewish cheese. And you know, if there was a specific Jewish cheese, I would have used the word, but being ignorant, ignorance, madam, pure ignorance. I don't know of any specific Jewish cheese. That would have been a perfect conclusion. But yeah, the Republicans the Democrats are sharp cheddar, the Republicans are mild cheddar, but they're both cheese, the cheese party. And the Jews are the rat that eats the cheese. So that works in one way. Then again, the Jews eat the cheese, but then again, the cheese is made of rat's milk. I don't know if you've ever had cheese made out of rat's milk, but being the sick fuck you are, I wouldn't be surprised. Personally, wouldn't touch this stuff. Wouldn't touch it. But, well, let's see. The point here was the use of the term, you'll see this used a lot, edgy. Now, concept is flip speak here. That is, everything is turned on its head. Black is white, normal is abnormal, or abnormal is normal, more likely. So everything that the Jews do will be presented in the terms of its opposite. They say they're doing good, but actually they're doing bad. When they say something is edgy, therefore, what they really mean is it's conformist. And it's only distinguished from other conformism, the liberal party line, the Jewish agenda. Of course, it's never called a Jewish agenda, nor is it even mentioned as agenda. But what edgy means is that it conforms to the party line, but it's pushing forward even more quickly than the Jews would like. So if I say, I don't like to have sex with German shepherds, that's edgy. Why? Because the Jews favor promiscuity. If I say, homosexuality is perfectly nice and normal, that's not edgy. That's the going line. Everybody accepts that. Few people speak against that. But if I go even farther and say, oh, I like having sex with kids and dogs, then I'm being edgy because I'm going in the direction the people controlling society want me to go, but I'm a little ahead of where the mainstream is yet still today. You understand the concept? the Jews are trying to push America in a certain direction, and anything that helps them in that task is going to be described as edgy if it's slightly ahead of where the rest of the public is. And edgy is almost always an adjective thrown at, and that's what adjective literally means. It's like a javelin. I think it has the same root as a word. It's something that's thrown to something else. Edgy is the word that they throw at anybody pushing some bizarre form of sex. Almost always. You'll see an actor or an actress talking about their latest movie. Yeah, we didn't know if we could, you know, maybe a 12-year-old having sex in the movie 13, something like that. Kids, that you may recall that movie from a few years back. Anything that pushes the envelope on sex. Yeah, we didn't know if we could get away with that. Whoa, man. Get away with that, like frontal nudity and primetime TV. You know, and to all appearances, these people really think they're being cool. They're really showing how it's done. And none of these people seem to perceive that there's nothing cool about what they're doing at all. It's as conformist as it is possible to be. But it wins them rewards among their own set. Yeah, there might be an 80-year-old farmer and farmer's wife out in Dubuque who really don't like what they see. And those are the people who are offended, but those people don't have any political or social power. Those are the great knobs in the flyover country. I remember when my grandmother was alive, and, you know, she was at the very end of her life. I mean, 90 to 95, when I was around her daily, and, you know, she would watch Wheel of Fortune, and maybe she would watch another show or two, but there would, and I always felt glad because she couldn't hear very well, and, you know, the stuff on TV, and when you're that old and you're literally, I mean, you're almost out of energy and you've only got a couple hours of energy a day and you can't walk around that much, naturally you're going to, TV is something you can do, and just the amount of cringeworthy material on TV is just overwhelming. And I always, you know, she couldn't hear well enough to talk all that well about stuff, certainly not about anything in depth, and so many times one has, you know, they really need to just pick these motherfuckers up who put this stuff out over the airwaves and just cut their goddamn heads off. I mean, line them up against the wall and just machine gun these useless, sorry fuckers. And I really believe that. And the thing that I know, the people who produce this shit, that's just simply embarrassing. I mean, it's not art. It's not even really sleazy. It's just embarrassing. Low rent, crap, crud, everywhere you turn. This is what they mean when they say the Jews have taught America to think like Jews. Everything is dirty and everything traces back to this or that. That's why I never wholly dismiss the Christians, much as I despise them for different reasons. For their weakness, their servility, their hypocrisy. At least some of them, even the hypocrites, are trying to exalt some valueness or just some basic sense of taste. No matter how dumb or pathetic or hypocritical they are, at least they recognize some of the same things I do are just flat wrong. They're bad. They're low. I don't know which of those is the right term. Maybe they're all the right term. They all have a piece of what's wrong, but it's something, and this is what I see when I read Rosenberg. I understand what he means. It's the same thing to me. I don't think pride is a bad thing. I think pride can be a bad thing if it leads you away from reality as a feedback check on your pride, and you're just proud and you're, because it's me, 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 I'm going to assert what I say over everything else and fuck whether it corresponds to reality. I'm going to cause other people pain as long as it feeds my ego. That's a bad pride. But it's also bad to be humble a lot of times. Pride goeth before a fall, says the church, but pride goeth before a rise, say I. You know? Yeah, it can go both ways. But the church only admits to one of those truths. The proud will be... Why would you want the proud to be humbled? If their pride is based on something legitimate, it's not good that it be humbled. And this docile, servile, slavish, turn the other cheek, this mentality is why the Catholics, you know, and they have largest single religion in America, greatest number of adherents, yet they can't even stand up to the Jews. All it takes is one phone call. They don't believe their own bullshit. So maybe a pride injection would serve them well. Now, Americans seem to me, as I've said, they seem to me like so many processed chickens. And like everything these days, it's all fake and filler and filled with rap. I want to give you a nice little phrase I found. I was rereading some Mencken. And there is no writer like Mencken. Possibly Revelo P. Oliver, who is very much like a Mencken, who wrote only about race and religion and stuff. But there just isn't any writer like Mencken in terms of understanding that English is something to be gloried in and played with and used and have fun with it, always while maintaining clear and intelligible prose. And it's just so funny when you see people celebrate people like James Joyce, who are basically jokes, who are only read because they push the correct ideology. They're anti-nationalist, they're anti-racialist, anti-religion. And they're pushed, oh, they're so clever and so... James Joyce is not funny. James Joyce is only clever in the sense of, oh yeah, wow, I've come up with 85 different symbols, and if you understand what he's referring to... Anytime you have something that is complex purely for the sake of complexity and simply pleasing people who understand all the allusions and references, you really don't have anything. Something that's truly great can be appreciated on multiple levels. No common person appreciates Joyce. The only people who appreciate Joyce are college professors because they get all of the allusions and the references. But inherently when you read it, you get no verbal pleasure from reading it. You don't see the play of words, but in Mencken you do. And always, if Mencken uses a word you don't know, he's not using it incorrectly. He's not using it to be showy. He's using it because it either fits his poetic scheme or it means something slightly different, but importantly different from a more common and shorter word that he might have used. And no writing is... Writing should always be musical. At least to the strain of writers, and I'm in his line when it comes to that. Writing should be musical. There's only 26 letters. There's only about, I get this wrong sometimes, 44 or 70 sounds that the letters make. Right? So there's always a musical way to express whatever it is you want to say. And he, more than anyone else, is capable. Every single sentence has some charm in it, some special pleasure in it. I can't think of any other writer like that. And when you combine that with the great learning that Mencken had, why, you really have something. You have something worth rereading. And I've read... I have lots of Mencken's collections, and I read them over and over more than any other book. And it really doesn't matter what he's writing about. There's always some interesting, striking idea in it. The ideas and the way that they're put are just... It's matchless. And so what I'm saying is we don't have an America with that type of person in it today. We just have these mass-produced, read the label and, each person been shot full of 20% maybe solution, sugar solution or salt solution to bulk out the weight and charge you more. It's not even real meat, and that's how I feel about too many of the people in this country. They don't have distinct personalities. And I believe that Frenchman de Tocqueville, who cruised through the U.S. in the 1800s, he said more or less the same thing. Nowhere will you find a people with less individuality than Americans. They all have that same happy-ass, back-slapping, fake-smiling. Look at these women on the single sites. They have this, it's called a rictus. It's like, this is how I'm supposed to... I will so position my lips as to convey the emotion I believe that I am supposed to feel. So they peel their lips back in a horrible monkey grimace, technically called a rictus. I'm having fun. And that's what everything is about. You're supposed to be having fun all the time, nonstop. Fun, fun, fun. What the hell is fun? Why do you have to be happy all the time and having fun? Never understood that. It sounds like a great chore to have to be happy all the goddamn time. Having fun, being happy. Yeah. I like what Rosenberg has to say. See, this is why Catholicism, religion, and Nazism. It's why the Catholics hate the Nazis so much, because both of them have different values than the mass consumer, democratic, leveled value of having fun and being obedient and whatever. But they don't have the same values themselves, so they're at odds. And the Catholics don't want anyone taking away their market share. Yet, the Nazi idea, even though the carriers were defeated in World War II, remains alive, because people can see that just as there's something obviously wrong with mass consumerist democratic culture, there's also something wrong with mass religious culture, mass universalist, submissive, authoritarian, hierarchical culture of the Catholic Church. And always standing there is the danger that someone will rediscover and reawaken the kinds of things that Rosenberg was talking about. Now, as per usual with this show, we never even got around to item one. Maybe I'll go there now, but you know, I know that when I used to, in the days in which I used to write a lot, and maybe I'll get back to them one of these days, who knows, but because I don't find, the reason I started writing in the first place was I didn't find people writing the kind of stuff I wanted to read. Now, N.B. Forrest is one guy, if there were hundreds of writers like him, I probably wouldn't ever write, because I would just giggle and chortle. I am a great giggler and chortler over the kind of, I go, yeah, that's exactly right. That is exactly what I was thinking. Exactly. And it's such an utter delight. But there's so little of that nowadays. I mean, I just want to kick everything that falls under my eyes. I want to pick it up and just kick it. As angry as I felt when I saw Kevin MacDonald's book, and he's got that kike blurbing it on the back. I mean, I literally wanted to kick the book, and I had to restrain myself. What the hell is the guy thinking? You don't have a Jew blurb your book. The whole point is excluding Jews and drawing a line so that the average person can understand these are not your friend. These are your enemy. I don't know what it takes some of these genius minds on our side to figure that out. Too many of them fall back in the safe camp of conservative cowardice. The Sam Francis line. It won't work. It cannot work. Cannot work. You have to be willing to risk it all. You have to be willing to kill and die. Conservatism has no answers. Conservatism is organized cowardice. Now, I think we'll get on with my shopping agenda here today. For those of you who don't realize, that line about shopping agenda is from a movie. I think Mallrats, Ben Affleck, saying to the two punks, I really don't respect anyone who comes in here without a shopping agenda. To the two stoners who like to go to the mall and smoke pot and just hang around being useless. It's kind of funny in the movie. Now let's see. Okay. What have we got here? Do we have a failure to communicate? Let's see. Now, we'll talk a little about a couple of sports things I've observed, and then we'll move on to the agitprop terminology. I guess I already dealt with edgy. You think about that. Please notice what I say. Every time you hear someone or see something described as edgy, you'll note that it involves some form of sexual looseness, and the person in question is pushing the boundary, either toward kid sex, toward a younger age of consent, or towards bestiality, or towards homosexuality, or towards some loosening of standards of what's allowed to be shown in primetime on TV. And the actor will appear really pleased with himself, like, wow, I'm really cool. You know, I appeared in full frontal male nudity at 8 p.m. Eastern time. Wow, isn't that really pushing the boundaries? Wow, man. Sexual exhibitionism is such a cheap distinction, yet it seems to satisfy these raccoon people who frequent Hollywood. Wow, dude, your dick was on TV. You must be a hero.
or wow, you portrayed a 10-year-old having sex with a 30-year-old man. You're awesome, man. That's great. You're really pushing the boundaries. You're really edgy. You're really pushing the envelope. Wow. And this is how these people think. But you know what's so interesting is, you no more find real journalism in America no more frequently than you find real people. And I don't mean, I don't describe real people or mass consumer. I don't hate them the way that the leftists seem to hate them because of their vitriol in denouncing the suburbs. I grew up in the suburbs. I think it's perfectly fine. I don't think it's as good as being raised on a farm or raised in a small town around flocks of your own relatives. I know it's not as good as that. And usually what you see suburban life contrasted to is the city. Well, I don't know. I lived in the city. I hated it. I don't like the type of people in the big city. I don't like being around Jews and fags and people who and niggers and people who I know don't think in the same basic way I do. As far as I'm concerned, I greatly prefer living in a small town. I think it would be cool to have all kinds of relatives around and all of them with large flocks of children, but that's not how it is. I mean, my family spread out. They'd probably, for thousands of years, Linders lived happily in southern Germany and in Switzerland and some of the other European states, and they, you know, they were farmers and teachers and maybe here and there one of them was brilliant, but, you know, basically they were woodcutters and they had large flocks of kids and they lived around people who were like them, and that was perfectly fine. But, you know, life has really changed, and this is what they mean by modernism. And they say, you know, oh, everything's a move toward modernism, toward secularism, away from the small village, into the wider world, abandoning traditional practice. Well, what's so good about that? We have more options in one sense, but in another sense, we have fewer options. What's so good about having all of your relatives spread out around the country? As my family does, and I'm sure yours does too. What's so good about that? What's the point of being related to someone if they don't even live in the same general area? Even if you grew up with them, I mean, that's not really the way human life is meant to be lived, I don't think. You know, you're at the end of the day after you paid your 50% taxes, you have enough time and energy for one or two kids. Where's your aunt and your uncle? Well, they live somewhere else. You know, where's your grand? Well, they live somewhere else. You know, where are all the people you're supposed to grow up around and see each different slice of life? Everybody has a different perspective. Crazy aunt, your crazy uncle, you know, your cousins, your one brother or sister as opposed to your five or six brothers or sisters. I mean, my grandparents on my father's side, the ones from here in Kirksville, I mean, they grew up on farms, you know, probably a mile from each other, rural Adair County, not even in Kirksville. I think my grandmother's side, they had about eight. I mean, you know, Laura, Frankie, Irene, you know, Donald. I mean, just person after person after person. Yeah, some of them died, but lots of people. Same thing on my grandfather's side. So their generation goes from maybe eight people a family. My grandparents had five kids, but one of them died stillborn, their first child. And then they had four after that, four brothers. To my dad's generation, had three. To now my generation, whatever, most of them have either two or not even two. How is this an improvement? We pay more taxes, we have less time. Yeah, we have more money. We can buy more consumer electronics. Are we better off? I don't think so. My uncle's put together a couple of books. One was his own, and they're very well edited and laid out and very good slices of life of what it was like to grow up in Adair County when he did from, I think his first book about himself covered roughly 36 to 54. And then he put together another one based on my grandfather's diary. Pretty prosaic stuff. But he's got all kinds of photos and has it laid out and edited very nicely. And it really gives you a picture of what life used to be like. And yeah, people were poorer back then, but there were a lot more people. It was a more people-focused world. It was more serious. It was more adult. And I hope I've conveyed a little, and it comes through in the photographs in this book, because you see the large flocks of people. And look, these are all like Linders and their assorted cousins and Sheelys. That was my grandmother's name. You know, basically German-descended farmer people. And then my dad's generation grew up and went to expensive colleges and became successful and rich and suburban and upper middle class as opposed to country rural people. So is that better? That's kind of the promise. And maybe if you grow up with that background, it is better to become rich and upper middle class and take advantage of what America has to offer. But you know what? Money doesn't ultimately matter that much. And that's what the Nazis and the Catholic Church understand. A country's not ultimately about money. And what the Nazis were trying to do was rid that Jewish mentality, which has overtaken Americans today. Oh, is it better for a kid to have a father or a large bedroom? Well, plenty of upper middle class people believe that it's more important for a kid to have a large bedroom than to have a father around. They really do think that. They might not be able to conceptualize that or put it into words because it sounds awful, but that's what they truly believe when the chips are down. And that's how they act. And that's wrong. There's far too much emphasis on money in America. And I'm not anti-money. By no means should any white nationalist be anti-money. Money is a good thing. But it's not the ultimate thing. It's not the most important thing. If you have some artistic vision for life, or think you might be capable, you can live that way. You can have whatever you want. It may cost a higher price than you think, but you can do what you want to do. It's just a matter of thinking it through and arranging it. Things that Nordic people, that Aryan people are very good at. And I encourage you to do that. I mean, I probably used this example before, but you know, years and years ago, I had a girlfriend and she had a friend, and we went out with her and her friend's boyfriend, and this guy was a very good-looking guy, someone who might have had legitimate dreams of being an actor or being a face on TV, and his goal was to be an economist in the agriculture department. Sometimes I think people are too obsessed with safety or security. Or, you know, worst of all, and I understand this, believe me, getting health benefits, it's kind of a reduced life we live nowadays. And you see it in my uncle's books, you see it in the photographs more than anything. It's partly in the writing, but it's also in the photographs and just these large flocks of kids, such as today we would only associate with Mexicans. And like, you know, 20 young cousins and or whatever, and they're all... Half of them they're all tow-headed. They're all little blonde. They're little German people like me. We're all blonde when we're young, and then our hair gets darker as we get older. That way of living is gone. In a lot of ways, some of the people they call white trash or rednecks, the lower-level working-class people, maybe from the South. There's a lot of them up here in Missouri who are from the South, say Georgia or Florida. They come up here for whatever reason. I don't know, but... And they may even go beneath the working class and into the lumpen proletariat, kind of I don't know if that word can be described to rural criminals rather than urban criminals, if you understand what I mean. And maybe that's originally a Marxist term, but it means kind of where the working class bleeds into the overtly criminal or bum class. And there's a fair number of those people out here. They're bad seed families, but they actually still have a little of that. In some ways, I think they're luckier than the richer upper middle class northern people with their two kids and their insane liberal views. And that's what you find in the small town of Missouri. My uncle told me he estimated up here it was about 70-30 Civil War. About 70% were northern. Remember, we're 22 miles south of Iowa. And he said it was about 70% pro-northern, 30% pro-southern. They actually had a Civil War battle here, but still that mentality exists. The gentry in town, the people who run the town, are liberal cultists. They believe in racial equality, and Mr. Linder's giving our town a bad name. We don't want to be known as a place where hate exists. And they buy into all that. But lower than that, in the lower socioeconomic strata, are people who are more clannish. And perhaps this is an ethnic Scots-Irish type thing. But in a lot of ways, those people are luckier than the richer, smarter betters. Because the richer, smarter betters have bought into the cult and want to force everyone to think the same way they do. To use the line from the script of Ride with the Devil, which was about the Civil War in Missouri. But the lower level people, you know, say four-fifths of them work, and they may be kind of dumb and scummy, but they're not scummy in the nigger sense of they don't threaten others. They're not destroying others. They don't want to force other people to be like them. They might fight over, you know, a woman or something, but they're not out there raping and murdering people by and large. And in a lot of ways, those people have what their betters have either lost or forsaken. That's something I notice. So I wouldn't hesitate to advise any white nationalists out there, don't make money your obsession. Get as much money as you need, but small town life is great. It's especially great when you have the internet, so that all the intellectual sustenance you need is a fingertip away. Cities where the culture, yeah. Well, part of Rosenberg's ideas, and he was opposed to Goebbels in this in regard. Goebbels was kind of a big city guy. He was known as kind of the Red Nazi, and he was kind of a, he liked the cities and the actresses, and he had affairs with lots of actresses in addition to producing 6 children of his own. And, you know, he was the minister of propaganda and enlightenment, and he ran the radio and the movies and the TV in Germany. Well, Rosenberg's view was kind of different. He liked small town life, and he saw, like Thomas Jefferson did, cities as a kind of sinkholes of corruption and seduction. So they would seduce the strong, healthy, virile men from the farm, and kind of the idea, you know, how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris? Which was said after World War I. The idea is that war is very demoralizing. Not just because life ends much more quickly and you see the most brutal side of life it can show, but the very fact that you're exposed to all that tends to speed things up and make them larger in your mind. And I could see this in my one uncle, my grandmother's brother, who fought in World War II and was pretty much the only one in our family who did, because most of them were born so that they were too young. Linders were born pretty much right before all the war, so they weren't fighting in any of them after the Civil War. They fought the Revolution and the Civil War, but they didn't really fight in World War I or World War II, except for this one uncle. And you could just see the marked personality change that fighting. And he was shot by a German, and he had his elbow messed up by a German sniper in France. So he got whatever the military award was, Purple Heart, I think. And he had a Nazi flag, and he would talk occasionally, but not very often. And I always remember, I'll do my impression of what he sees. He's like, we come around one of them hills, and we see one of them panzers. Boy, we took off running. We was going through trees that thick. And he, if you know the other lenders around, they're generally pretty nice, fairly mild. They're kind of a, they have a streak to them, which you can pick up in me. But, I mean, you can see how war kind of, I'm not sure the right way to put this, probably something involving soup and being heated and bringing out the essence. It kind of brings it out. It brings out the personality. Probably a lot of that's just being in the army. And it forces you to be more overt and expressive and get rid of any kind of lingering Midwestern shyness you might have. But it also demoralizes people. It accustoms them to doing things they wouldn't do in ordinary life. People are very adaptable. They can adapt to different circumstances very quickly. Now, I totally lost my track of thought there, but essentially, whites run the risk of being turned into livestock, farm animals. Not real meat, but people stuffed with Jewish solution to flesh them out, make them whole. And I really think that you don't see much distinct personality in America. How often do you meet someone and think, that person is really genuinely interesting or different from the rest? No, they seem very much alike. Maybe it always ever was that way. But maybe it's also a function of all the transportation we have and all the media we have today and the jadedness from overexposure. The fact that the world is now a small town in the sense of the downside of a small town is there's everybody knows your business, and now it's like we know everybody's business because it's all over the media all the time, so we feel like we know everything, even if we really don't. And it lends a certain sameness. And human society just doesn't seem to be able to sustain itself. It doesn't seem to be able to sustain different poles of thought in the same society. There has to be one orthodoxy, and you either subscribe to it or you're a bad guy. And if the Jews are setting that orthodoxy, you know that what they're going to intend for us. Why wouldn't you ever hear someone saying what I'm saying right now over the commercial airwaves? Why would anybody who talked the way I do be fired if he tried to speak what I'm saying over ABC or Clear Channel Radio or ESPN? Why would he be fired? Why would it be unthinkable that someone would be allowed to go on the air and spend an hour uninterrupted by commercials criticizing Jews and lamenting the fact that Palin is such a perfect representation of America? Not real smart, but kind of cheerleadery, happy. It just doesn't seem like a very adult nation in the most important ways. Now, let's see. What was I wanted to talk about sports a little. Just a couple of interesting things that I observed. And before too long, we'll get on to the article from Culture Wars. Tell you what, I think I need to take a 2-song break here, and then we'll come back, we'll talk about sports, and then we will talk about either the Culture Wars article or an agitprop term, but that's our mainstay coming up. I got a little carried away there, talked for about an hour and 10 minutes. Anyway, I think there's some ideas in there, so I'm going to play 2 songs, and I will be right back.
3 buns and donuts and fruitcake with no nuts, so good you could go nuts.
You're going to have all those things when you get home.
No, now! I want a ball! I want a party! Pink macaroons and 1,000,000 balloons and performing baboons and give it to me! Now! I want the world! I want the whole world! I want to lock it all up in my pocket. It's my bar of chocolate. Give it to me now. I want today. I want tomorrow. I want to wear 'em like braids in my hair, and I don't want to share 'em. I want a party with roomfuls of laughter, 10,000 tons of ice cream. And if I don't get the things I am after, I'm going to scream! I want the works, I want the whole works, presents and prizes and sweets and surprises of all shapes and sizes, and now, don't care how, I want it now. Don't care how, I want it now.
Oompa, loompa, doompa-dee-doo. I've got another puzzle for you. Oompa, loompa, doompa-dee-dee. If you are wise, you'll listen to me. Who do you blame when your kid is up? Rat pampered and spoiled like a Siamese. Cat blaming the kids is a lie and a shame. You know exactly who's to blame. The mother and the father. Oompa, loompa, doompa-dee-da. If you're not spoiled, then you will go far. You will live in happiness too. Like the Oompa Loompa Loompa-dee-doo.
That was from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Veruca Salt, the character in there, singing, not the band, I Want It Now. And that kind of speaks to the American mentality of, it speaks to the fundamental problem with the democratic process that they exalt so, that anyone without any learning, without even being a citizen, is allowed to vote.
and no restrictions of place, property, or station need apply. The idea that you're going to get good leadership out of that or that it will be anything other than manipulated is ridiculous. But that's the mentality. No barriers. That's the problem with America as it evolved. And impatience with any kind of restriction, rational, legal, or otherwise, and a demand for immediate gratification. And we're paying the price for it. Now, here's a song by a Jewish pervert, and this is a good example. I was talking earlier about edginess and pushing the envelope and the Jewish obsession with sex and secretions and shit. And this song really embodies what I'm talking about. Let's listen to it. It's called This One's On Me. It's by Jim Krusen, who I believe is a Jew. I'm 90% sure he's a Jew. Kikes always promote this kind of stuff in their music. Enjoy.
I was hitching through Georgia one evening last June. I took a ride from a trucker by the light of the moon. As I stared out the window, I felt a hand on my knee. I said, go right ahead, man, cause this one's on me. This one's on me, it's the least I can do, cause my baby don't want me and I'm feeling so blue. But I surely am grateful for your kindness, you see. So I got you covered and this one's on me. Camped out with some hippies down near Baton Rouge. Just then I remembered that joint in my shoe. We passed it and we puffed it till we near couldn't see. But before I passed out, I said, this one's on me. Oh, this one's on me, it's the least I can do. Cause my baby don't want me and I'm feeling so blue. But I surely am grateful for your kindness, you see. So I got you covered and this one's on me. Now every time some car goes driving on by, a memory of you brings a tear to my eye. I'm love's lonesome highway in a cloud of debris. You drove on past mountain parks, so this one's on me. This one's on me, it's the least I can do. While my head's full of whiskey and my heart's full of you. Don't care where I'm going, I don't care who I see. Drawn past open hearts, so this one's on me. I told my story to a woman named Jo, the lesbian commune way down in New Mexico. With my tears on her shoulder by the shade of a tree, she said, pour out your soul, boy, cause this one's on me. This one's on me, it's the least I can do. So sit on down and empty that sand from your shoes. Ain't it hard when a broken heart won't let you be? Set yourself down now, cause this one's on me. Set yourself down now, cause this one's on me.
Alright, now that was This One's On Me by Jim Krusen. And I think you can understand that whenever you have a Jew, you have that kind of material, you know, always something, homosexual, lesbian commune, homosexual trucker,
cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's always like that. Always sex, always scatological. And the Jew is calm enough and patient enough to know that it takes time to advance his agenda. He can't simply boil the frog. He has to turn the heat up degree by degree. So as you go back over the years and listen to both Jewish comedians and the people they promoted, you'll hear degree by degree by degree, both in music and in comedy, as they advance their agenda of demoralizing whites and stripping them of their racial identity and their cultural ways by mocking them and by training them to act like Jews and think like Jews. And Jews, as I've said many times, and this, they associate sexual continence, sexual loyalty, self-control, all these things traditionally regarded as good in white Western Christian European civilization are regarded by Jews as bad because they see them as tied to anti-Semitism. A man who is careful with his little head will tend to be careful with his big head. If he fucks clearly, chances are he will think clearly. And if he thinks clearly, and he trains his thinker upon Jews, well, my friend, the Jew knows what he's going to find. He's going to find that the Jew is his enemy, because that's what an objective study of all Jewish history and behavior will show. The Jew is the enemy of the civilized white man. Ah, hell, the civilized Muslim and the civilized Japanese, too. The Jew is the enemy of all other people. He means to undermine them and wreck their nations. They brag about this. We lied. It was how you got through life, Monica Lewinsky. Nothing you Gentiles do will ever satisfy us. I think that was Maurice Samuel in a book in the first half of the 20th century. Some call it communism. I call it Judaism. Rabbi Stephen Wise, the most prominent rabbi in America in the 20th century, the first half. Who is the Jewish neocon within the last couple of years? We're creative destroyers. We are history's actors. While you're studying what we do very judiciously, we're out there acting and changing the world yet again. We destroy all traditions. We break down all laws. So they see themselves as these brilliant iconoclasts, whether they're thinkers or policy advisors or speech writers like Frum, Horowitz, Wolfowitz, Pearl, or whether they're comedians like Lenny Bruce or Mort Saul. They're always cutting edge, man. They really see what's going on, and they're not afraid to say it. Now, what it is a bunch of ethnic Jews who work together as a team to undermine this society that's polite enough or foolish enough to host them without recognizing them for what they are, or it never would have admitted them in the first place. But once admitted, they must do all within their power to take control, lest we come to understand the root of the depredations they practice. The Jews are the mockers who can't stand being mocked. They are the institutional critics, the critics of our institutions who can't bear any examination of their own institutions. They have a glass jaw. We aren't allowed to discuss them and observe things about them in the way that they are about us. They can't take it, both literally and figuratively. They can't take it literally, because if they allow it, it will quickly become to be seen that what I'm saying, what every other Jew critic is saying, is the truth. They are hostile to our very type of people, let alone our institutions and our way of life and the way that we think. Figuratively, they can't take it because they're weak. laugh at them, cry at them. They start screaming about anti-Semitism. They don't have any defense. They can't defend themselves in a way that we Aryans recognize as valid. Thus forever, Aryans and white people and conservatives and right-wingers and honest white men are forever protesting, but what do their protests accomplish? They accomplish nothing. Because they're based on the unexamined assumption that Jews are like us, and that they merely need to be shown the error of their ways for them to correct it and acknowledge the hypocrisy, acknowledge the double standard, and redress it. But Jews aren't like us. We have made the mistaken assumption that different species are or should be operating by the same standard. But that's not how reality works. The Jews are a different species from whites, just as Jews and whites are different species from blacks and from Mexicans and Asians. They don't live by the same standard. They can't meet the same standard. They're not the same creature. It's as ridiculous as expecting a schnauzer to live the way a German shepherd does, or the way a Maltese does. They're not the same breed. They have their own ways of doing things. And it so happens that Jews are a breed that is modified to take advantage of goyish mindsets and goyish institutions and undermine them as a way of feeding itself. And this should be no surprise. Every form of life in the kingdom of nature has parasites. And Jews are a parasite upon the white community. They may look sort of human-like, but in fact they're parasites on the Gentile host. We don't need them. They need us. They can't get along without whites. They say we're all potential Nazis and all we do is hate them and kill them, but when a state is established for them in the Middle East, none of them want to go there. That's the problem with Israel. They are being outbred by the Palestinians, the native Palestinians, the Arabs and the Muslims, and they can't get enough Jews to move back there. Because for all the hatred they spew towards us and all the lies they tell about us, look at their behavior. They stay among us. They batten upon our hide and they draw our blood. Why the heck would they want to leave? The answer is they wouldn't want to leave. They can't leech upon each other in Israel. They leech upon us. Israel really is a giant leech because so much of its funding comes out of your and my pocket. Because the Jews have control of Congress, and they can destroy the career of any congressman who dares to point out how evil they are and how much their interests oppose us. And how much money they suck out of us. Anybody who dares talk about those things will be hounded from office. Until we remove this Jewish parasite, we're not going to be a free nation. We're going to be a bunch of happy-ass clowns, mulcted in every possible way by our masters, the loathsome parasite known as the Jew. Part of controlling the Aryan people is setting up mass spectacles bred in circuses of Roman times to keep the throng of morons occupied, and obviously sports fills a great deal of what might otherwise be devoted to real politics or nationalism or tribal politics. And so sports serves as a sort of ersatz nationalism, as many people have observed. And what we found in the mass sports is that almost always the commissioner of these sports is a Jew. Now, recently, the only sport that had a non-Jewish commissioner was football, and that was Paul Tagliabue, and he was replaced by another goyim, at least as far as I know, Roger Goodell. The other sports still have Jewish bosses, Gary Bettman of the NHL and David Stern of the NBA, and Bud Selig of Major League Baseball. So three out of the four major sports are run by Jews, and of course Jews also run boxing. They're the top promoters in boxing as well. and they own the television stations over which these events are broadcast. And I thought it was funny. World Series is going on now, and they played a game last night. And since it's, you know, late October and the game is being played in Philadelphia, of course you have the risk of bad weather. They went ahead and started it anyway, and it started raining, and they had to stop after the sixth inning, tied 2-2. But what I thought was interesting and worth mentioning was that the Jew who runs Major League Baseball, Bud Selig, said that he simply wasn't going to allow the game to end at 2-1. Now, I could be wrong about this, but in baseball, anytime the home team is leading after 5 innings or 4.5 innings, that is, the visiting team has had its 5th at bat, and the home team is leading and the game is called, the home team wins and you don't have to complete the game. And that's a rule. It's not something that's subject to will or whim or interpretation. It's the rule. Now, it so happened in the game last night that it did end up 2-2, and it was rainy enough that they decided to suspend play. And I'll pick it up some later time. But the point was, you have this Jew basically saying, the team that was trailing, the visiting team, was losing 2-1 in the top of the sixth. If they had not scored, the score would have been 2-1 going into the bottom of the sixth when it became unplayable, or they decided to declare it unplayable. And if that had been the case, under normal conditions and under the actual rule, the Phillies would have won 2-1 as the game was called after 5.5. And what this Jew said, Selig, was, I wasn't going to allow it to end that way. We're not going to allow the World Series to conclude in a game suspended after 5.5 innings, it would have been. So basically, from what I can tell, this Jew is simply asserting that I don't care what the rule says, I wasn't going to allow that to happen. Even though the Phillies, in any ordinary game, would have won 2-1, if it had been 2-1, when the game was suspended going into the bottom of the sixth. So Stern was bailed out of that by the fact that the Rays scored a run in the top of the sixth, tying it at 2-2. But I thought it very interesting and very much in line with what we see from Jews in every other arena. If there's a law they don't like, they simply break it. If they're on a court, they simply reinterpret it in the way they want it reinterpreted. And this is what they've done all through history. When I'm reading the book about Alfred Rosenberg, he ended up being hanged. And why was he and the other Nazis hanged? Well, there were no laws against what they did. The Jew-controlled Allies simply made up ex post facto laws after the war and hanged them on the basis of those, not just overt soldiers and fighters and strategists and generals, but propaganda people, people in the media. People like Goebbels, who put out media, people like Rosenberg, who was a philosopher and a thinker, and people like Stryker, who was a newspaper editor, were hanged for nothing more than their ideas. And they were hanged on the basis of laws that didn't exist. So this is how the Judeo-left, the Judeo-Bolsheviks operate. All they care about is power. Written law means nothing to them. If it's on their side, of course they'll cite it. If it's not on their side, they'll pound the table or pull up sociology statistics or cite their own psychiatrists as experts. They'll do whatever they have to do to get their point across. They don't care what the rules are, whether it's in baseball or World War or anything else. Remember Brown versus Board of Education that we protested a few years ago, 50th anniversary. Or what was that? The law was settled. The judge is supposed to go by the law. It's not up to him to write new law. It's up to him to follow law as set by the legislature. What did the Jews do? They twisted the arms of the judges in the Supreme Court. They made it into a matter of power. And they used it as a cover, or their pretext, for creating new law. Well, sociologists say that blacks need to go to school around whites in order to have a valid education. Well, that's not what the people said through the legislature that expresses their will. Just ignore it. That's what the Jews do. Ultimately, it's all about power. There's no principle on the left other than we must have all the power and no place, no room for the right. Herbert Marcuse, no room for anything on the right. They have no rights at all. Repressive tolerance. Wherever the left takes power, it will move to squash all opposition, again, because it represents such a small view. Only now, because it's been so many decades that the left has had power unopposed, it's not such a small view anymore. A much higher percentage of the population supports leftism because leftism is all it has ever been exposed to. Because in line with the principle of no room for the right, no space for the right, no place for hate, the years of demonization, stigmatization, isolation, ostracism of people, personalities, and ideas that represent the opposite of what the left stands for, truth, fact, reason, and order, the minds of a substantial portion of the population have been queered, to say nothing of their direct physical benefits in sucking off the benefits that the left obtains from them through the from the pockets of the people who work for a living. So, and anybody who thinks Jews are talented or gifted, it's funny as hell to watch Bud Selig trying to speak. If you ever see him, the guy can't, he's like a Jewish George Bush, he can't say anything. Even a leftist professor observed that Bush speaks very clearly when it's negative or when he's angry. It's when he's trying to apologize or explain something or be polite that he has a great deal of problems and trips all over his tongue. I've never seen Bud Selig speak anything directly. Yet he is a Jew and he runs the Major League Baseball. Now, I also found a quote that I think is interesting, and this also pertains to sports. So we've seen the example of Selig tyrannically, and of course the media being what it is, did not make it clear whether or not he's just making a command executive decision, and if so, what right has he to do that given the rules? I mean, theoretically, his decision, if it had been 2-1 going into the bottom of the sixth, that no, this game can't end that way, even though every regular season game could end that way, and I'm not aware of any rule that says that that rule changes in the playoffs or the World Series. No reporter really called him out on that I saw. Said, are you just, you know, saying the rules don't apply here? Or what is the deal? No one called him out on that. Well, leaving that and turning to, there's a guy who writes for ESPN called The Sports Guy. His name is Bill Simmons, and he's kind of, I guess, the apotheosis of what the adult white male is supposed to be in this country. He began as sort of a Boston sports blogger, super into every sport possible, or at least the main ones, and total fan. And buyer of lots of memorabilia and super into all the niggers and their statistics like so many people are, and super into fantasy sports. And he has become a columnist, and he's good at what he does. He's a good writer. He knows a lot of pop culture. He fills a lot of movie references in along with his sports analysis and his fantasy league stuff. He also does a couple of different podcasts. Not a bad guy, but kind of a perfect example of what the Jews want white males to be, these ultimate spectators. Spectating and kibitzing and admiring professional athletes. Anyway, he makes a number of interesting points, and he's not really overtly political most of the time. It's pure sports, but he will throw in little bits that someone who knows what you and I know from reading VNN and from years of reading white nationalist authors and thinking about this stuff, he throws in stuff that can be taken in quite a different way, or has a different meaning if you know the context, that I'm sure this guy himself doesn't. He knows sports very deeply. I mean very deeply. He remembers specific seasons and what happened very, very, at a much greater level than even an average fan would. But he made this point in an article. He says, talking about Gary Bettman, he says, I thought about buying the NHL package on DirecTV last week so I could have breakup sex with the Bruins for a year. The cost, $169. Really, Gary? That's how you treat your mostly blue-collar fans who can't afford good seats for games anymore?
the ones you've already insulted 300 times over? I continue to think Stern planted Bettman to sabotage the NHL, and no one can tell me different. Now, that's a throwaway line, and he doesn't really mean it, but then again, from a white nationalist point of view, that's pretty interesting. There was a great article that appeared on one of the other white nationalist sites a couple of years ago talking about rule changes in hockey and how they kind of eviscerated its fighting appeal to the working class, rural, you know, Canadian and northern U.S. fans who are the ones who like hockey because, you know, that it fits their weather and their climate and their background, whereas people in the South and the West, you know, they don't play hockey in America. And the point is, Gary Bettman is a Jew. He's the head of the NHL. He's a Jew. He was a protege of David Stern, who is the smooth-talking Jew who heads up the NBA and is turning it into a global game, as they're trying to do with all of these mass sports leagues. And so it's very interesting that the most prominent columnist at ESPN would say that Jew Stern, head of a league that is about 80% black, would send out his young feeder Jew to run hockey. And again, hockey is about as un-Jew as it's possible to get, and as white as it's possible to get, and as non-black as it's possible to get. And that under this Jew's tutelage, his leader as commissioner of NHL, they would change the rules to end the fighting that was such a staple of it. And actually, a little fighting saves a lot of fighting. Or that is what this article argued, and I wish I could remember so I could give the credit to whoever wrote it or where it appeared, and I don't remember, but this article made the point that when you get rid of the fighting that A, the fans like, you're also endangering the players, because when they can't fight, there's more high sticking and stuff that's truly lethal, because the stuff can't be settled on ice any other way. So once you've undercut the fan appeal and you've changed the nature of the game in order ostensibly to make it more fan-friendly and to draw a higher audience, but the NHL has failed with its rule change to draw a higher audience. And that may be for non-political, non-Jewish, skulduggeric, if that's the adjective, reasons. Part of it's just that hockey may not, for whatever reason, translate as well to a mass audience because of the audience's background, or maybe just because it doesn't play as well on TV. But it's very interesting that a Jew would be that commissioner of hockey, a sport that Jews have nothing to do with whatsoever. B, that they would implement a rule that makes it less attractive to its white fan base. C, that they would charge exorbitant prices even to view the sport. And D, that this white columnist would even issue such a throwaway line. And it makes you wonder, you know, in jest truth, just as in wine truth, get drunk, you speak the truth. Well, I mean, in laughter and mocking, there's truth. And maybe it's put in the form of mocking or the form of jesting because it's dangerous to speak it directly. That's why they had court jesters in days of old. You know, so you could, at one hand, you could safely dismiss what this clown in the three-pointed hat is saying and jumping around and acting goofy. Well, yeah, he's a court jester, you know, what the hell. But on the other hand, he's the only one allowed to speak the truth, because if you speak the truth plainly, it's dangerous. I continue to think Stern, Jew Stern, planted Jew Bettman to sabotage the all-white NHL so that it wouldn't overtake the almost all-black NBA or increasingly black NFL, and no one can tell me different. That's another spin to put upon Bill Simmons' words. Very interesting. And who knows what the actual truth is. Now, I could go on and on in sports. I'll go on a little bit longer. One interesting thing has been, I saw yesterday that Ty Willingham is out at Washington, I think, at the end of the year, Washington University. They have a lousy record. Now, the interesting part here is Ty Willingham, I believe, and I could be wrong on the data here, but I'm not wrong in the substance. He's a black coach
not a bad guy, but a black coach. And ESPN is a totally Jewish operation. It operates out of Connecticut. It was originally set up to, like, televise Connecticut high school sports, and quickly they realized, like, geez, there's a mass world market for televised sports that no one has really ever properly tried to capture. Let's do it. And they succeeded beyond their wildest dreams. They are the dominant force in sports worldwide. They're totally Jewy. They're owned by ABC, or else ABC ESPN. They're part of that whole family, and they've been totally Jewy from day one, and they have a very strong political agenda. And that agenda is always promoting blacks over whites. And any niche or cranny in sports that isn't already filled with blacks, they want to inject blacks in there to diversify it and open it up. In particular, I'm thinking of, hockey or NASCAR or baseball, which has seen the share of blacks drop from about 28% of the lineups or the starters down to about 9%. Of course, a lot of them have been replaced with Mexicans and Latins, who I don't even think they count as black. Nevertheless, the important thing is that Major League Baseball sponsors something called RBI, which is like reviving baseball in the inner cities, and they set up all of these academies in the inner cities to try to get more blacks into Major League Baseball. And they also set up academies down in Latin America to try to get more browns into baseball. Because you see, college baseball is dominated by white players, and you can well believe that a lot of these white players are just as good as these Latin players, but the Latin players provide the diversity that the Jews want for political and financial reasons. They want browns and blacks to have opportunities that are denied whites. On the football front, this has always meant promoting black coaches over whites. In the NFL, they have the Rooney Rule, which is, I don't know if it's a formal agreement or if it's just a private agreement, that anytime there's a coaching vacancy among, what are there, about 32 teams, anytime there's a coaching vacancy, a minority must be interviewed for the position. Not hired, but interviewed. You must interview a minority anytime a head coaching vacancy comes up in pro football. Rooney Rule. They don't care that blacks are most of the starters. The only white positions today are essentially quarterback and the interior lineman on the offensive line. Few receivers, a few defenders here and there, but by and large it's black. It's much blacker than in the 80s. It was about 50-50 on the field, the starters, about half black, half white. Now it's more like 80-20. And there's obvious and overt discrimination at certain positions where they simply will not allow whites to play certain types of running back, although there has been a growth in white receivers, because unlike niggers, whites actually catch the ball, whereas the most prominent black names, not always but usually, drop the ball much more than whites do. They also downplay the number of whites that are extremely fast, and they always say they're sneaky fast, or they use some kind of adjective to imply that whites aren't naturally fast, whereas in fact plenty of whites are extremely fast, and speed is only part of it. But let's stick to the coaching for right now. Anyway, Ty Willingham used to be coach at one of the most prominent football institutions in the country, Notre Dame. Notre Dame had been a dominant football power in the middle decades of the 20th century, so it's one of the great schools in terms of a football legacy, along with like USC and, you know, later on the Florida State and Miami more in the 80s, Nebraska, that type of thing, Ohio State, Michigan. Anyway, I would have to guess that Ty Willingham was the first black coach Notre Dame ever hired, and he had a five-year contract, but they got rid of him after 3 years, either 2 or 3 years, because the record was so bad and they thought the team was going the wrong way. And the Jews at ESPN denounced this firing or this parting of ways with Ty Willingham because they said, well, that's the first time Notre Dame, I think, had ever gotten rid of a coach before his contract was up. And so the Jews at ESPN naturally portrayed it as a racial deal. Well, they're getting rid of him because he's white, or because he's black, not because he's bad. They really played that up. And then when Notre Dame brought in Charlie Weiss from the world champion New England Patriots, and his team did incredibly poorly his first 2 years, they started raising all the old questions about how lousy Weiss was, and how come they didn't let him go like they did Willingham? Well, this year Notre Dame has responded and done better as he's got his own people in. They've gotten back to winning, whereas Ty Willingham at Washington has now been fired by them, in effect. So, as usual, we see that the Jews lie about the reason. They lie in order to get blacks privileges and advantages and opportunities they couldn't get by their own merits. And in football, this translates into they really push hard, they being the dominant media outlet, really pushes hard to get blacks in as football quarterbacks and as head coaches. They really want to drive whites out of being quarterbacks, and they really want to drive whites out of being head coaches in the NFL. They don't care at all about talent. It's always assumed wherever whites dominate something, it's because of racism, and blacks fail to dominate or fail to achieve statistical parity because of discrimination rather than lack of talent. Wherever blacks dominate is due to talent. Just as when Jews are kept out of Harvard, it's always because of discrimination. But when whites are kept out of Harvard, well, it's just because Jews are hard working. They're smarter. They work really hard. So heads you win, tails you lose is how it always is in the Jew media with regard to whites. And whites, this is you and me, our kids, our opportunities are being denied by these people who can't create a society on their own. They have to come into our society and take it over. Jews routinely are admitted to schools without the qualifications that whites have. Whites go to the third tier schools, pay huge amounts of money, they don't even come away with a name on their diploma that's worth anything. Whereas Jews with inferior qualifications are admitted to the top schools so that they have every possible social advantage going for them. This is ordinary ethnic networking, and it's anti-white, even though our people created Harvard and Yale and the Ivy League. Our people created the hospitals and the foundations. Our people created the sports. Our people created the leagues when there was no money in them. Our people were the best players. The Jews come into this settled situation and take it over. Fill it with niggers. Drive as many whites out as they possibly can. Jews love black quarterbacks. They love black head coaches. It doesn't matter how incompetent they are. Look at the Jew Al Davis running the Oakland Raiders. He's an Art Shell, not a very good coach. Gets rid of his recent white coach because he won't play Jamarcus Russell, who's a great talent according to him. Look at the fall of the black quarterback, though. Heavily, heavily promoted by ESPN. Oh, we got to get more black quarterbacks. Blacks don't have the judgment. They don't have the throwing accuracy either, generally. Generally, a black quarterback is someone who's very fast, like Michael Vick. He can run very fast. And that works in college, where he can simply outrun the inferior opposition. But when they get to the pros, everybody's fast. Comes down to being a matter of judgment as much as anything. It's not so much about doing great things as avoiding doing bad things. And niggers stink at avoiding doing bad things because their IQ is very low, taking one with another. So an intelligent black quarterback can succeed, but those are few and far between. Most of them are simply fleet of foot, but as fleet as they are of foot, they are slow of lobe. They are backward of brain. And so we see that Vince Young, the only undefeated team in the league at this point, is Tennessee Titans. They had one of the top black quarterbacks and most heavily promoted athletes in the country, Vince Young, as their leader going into the season, but he's so screwed up mentally and so backwards in his talent that he's been replaced by a white journeyman. And one common theme in the NFL over the last couple of years has been taking black quarterbacks out after a couple of games and replacing them with these white 35 to 40 year olds who, for all their not being all that quick of foot, are simply better quarterback than these heavily promoted blacks. Why? Because they have better judgment and they are more accurate passers. And ESPN, the Jews at ESPN, their agenda is promote, oh, there's a new prototype quarterback. He's super fast afoot. He's like another tailback. But always what it comes back to is the blacks lack the necessities, as Al Campana said in a different setting
in baseball a few decades ago, talking about why there weren't many black managers. Well, blacks lack the necessity to be quarterback, generally. And that's why so many of them have failed and been replaced by whites. Interesting to note that San Francisco 49ers just fired their white head coach, Mike Nolan, and replaced him with a black, Mike Singletary. And one of his first acts was to demote the starting white quarterback, JT O'Sullivan, and replace him with Sean Hill, who's a black, who I predict will fail. Just like Tavares Jackson in Minnesota. And there's three examples. Heavily promoted Vince Young is dumped in favor of Kerry Collins. We've seen it other years. Brad Johnson replaced an incompetent black a couple years ago. Tavares Jackson was replaced by Gus Frerotte up in Minnesota. So what it comes down to is blacks simply don't have what it takes, but ESPN will never acknowledge that there's a racial component to it. There can only be a racial component where it works against whites and in favor of blacks or Jews. There's never any racial bias the other way. It's never acknowledged or admitted to. Just as whites can never break barriers in sports, you never see ESPN playing up the white world champion 400-meter sprinter because he's white. You don't see any Nike ads talking about Jeremy Warner breaking barriers. Only where blacks move into white turf do you see the Jews at ESPN promoting it. The only golfer you ever hear about is Tiger Woods. Why? Because he's part black. Not even mostly black. He's part black. I mean, he's rather obviously more Asian and white than he is black, at least in his outlook and his mentality. He doesn't come across niggery in the slightest other than his looks to some degree. But he celebrated this wonderful black. Anywhere whites are driven out, it's a good thing for Jews politically. And since they spend so much of their time, and since they have so much of their money tied up in getting whites to love sports, they want to reap some political advantages from it as well as financial advantages. It's very much like the movies, like any kind of entertainment. The first priority of this stuff is political. They have an agenda, and yes, making money is part of it, but making money is not their top goal. Their political agenda is number one. They'll take less profits if it means better politics. Better politics means getting more whites to believe their lies. Now, geez, we've already been going like 2 hours. I could probably talk forever about this stuff. But the reason I like talking about it is because you don't hear anyone else talking about it, and yet it's obviously what's going on. With William Pierce dead, we need to have as much good white radio out there as possible. So you'll never see anyone at ESPN or any of its columnists discussing this stuff. I mean, I remember a column. I don't know if I've talked about this on Radio Astina before. I think I've written about it a little, but the same columnist I mentioned, Bill Simmons, and he's an non-Jew, obviously. He's a normal white guy, like a Roman Catholic, at least nominally, from Boston. And he had a line in one of his things. He writes a lot about movies, 80s. He's my generation, a little bit younger, and he knows 80s movies and 70s movies and 90s movies, and he'll throw in lots of references. But he wrote that he couldn't even, in his column once, that he couldn't even mention this line from the Bad News Bears, which is from the character Tanner O'Boyle, and his line was, "All we got in this team are a bunch of Jews, spicks, niggers, pansies, and a booger-eating moron." And Bill Simmons wrote, he literally couldn't even cite that line. He literally couldn't type out the words in that line in his column because of the political correctness at ESPN. Think about that. Whites are essentially being managed to a predestined conclusion, and that is no more of us existing anywhere, our thought patterns being wiped out, none but those imbued with the Jewish ideology allowed to exist or hold any kind of office. Everything else must be underground, literally or figuratively. Anything Jews don't like is hate, and must be made illegal. We must get to the point where anti-Jewish ideas never even occur to someone, much less are expressed.
And I think that's enough on sports. Why don't I play? I'm going to have to take a little break here. I'm going to play 2-3 more songs. And I always choose songs. I want you to listen to the words in these songs. I don't have any didactic stuff for the next couple I'm going to play, but most of these songs, some of them are just ones I like, but a lot of them have, there's a specific thing in them that I want to talk about. When I come back, we'll discuss the Jones article on thought control at the Catholic University as we move into hour three of Radio Istina. Istina being the opposite of Pravda. Pravda being the noble lie, or the ignoble lie, really, but the big lie, the ideological truth, what's supposed to be. Niggers are supposed to be dominant quarterback. They're supposed to be great managers. They just, in fact, aren't. But you're not supposed to notice that they aren't. You're supposed to join the cult they've set up for you and repeat these lies, but we're all equal. It's all good. Possibly, you know, it seems like an innocent expression. It's not. Think about what "it's all good" means. It's not all good. Don't make any distinctions. Don't think. Thinking is hate. Because if you think and you reach a conclusion through logical thought, through careful thought, through correct thought, I hesitate to use the word correct because of its connotations, association with political correctness, but if reality is of a piece, if there is order to the universe, if we have sense organs that can perceive what is going on, if we can form ideas from these observations and from our experience, and if we can net these ideas into an association that provides us an accurate picture, then we're going to be able to understand what is actually going on in the world and how we are being used or abused by the people who have the power. And the Jews don't even want us thinking the wrong things, of course. They don't even want us thinking at all, because you're going to end up in what they consider the wrong place, and which I consider the right place, understanding yourself in the proper context for the first time in your entire life. This is who I am. This is who my people are. This is our racial soul. This is how we live. This is what we value. And this is how it is being torn asunder, ripped up, and lied about by the people who have actual control in the United States and in the formerly white West. And this is a bad thing, and this is something I want to spend my life fighting and reversing, ultimately subduing and ending for all times the threat the Jews posed to the noble Aryans, of which you listening are a member. Remember, to a Jew, an anti-Semite is just a Gentile. If you're not Jewish, you're an anti-Semite. You may not be a Nazi, but to them you are. Whether you declare yourself or feel yourself to be one or not. A white is a Nazi to a Jew. A Gentile is a Nazi to a Jew. Everything that isn't a Jew is a Nazi to a Jew. If the Jews are guilty of all these things I've said about them, then maybe the people that they hate the most, they hate because those people understood what they were up to and fought them and won in a time and a space. Did you ever think about that? All history and media become comprehensible when you realize that the Jews are the bad guys, and we, ordinary, normal white people, are the good guys. Keep that in mind, listen to a couple songs, and I'll be right back.
Jesse is a friend. Yeah, I know he's been a good friend of mine. Lately something's changed, it ain't hard to define. Jesse's got himself a girl and I wanna make her mine. And she's watching him with those eyes, and she's loving with that body, I just know it. And he's holding her in his arms late, late at night. Play along with the charade that
doesn't seem to be a reason to change. You know, I feel so dirty when they start talking cute. I wanna tell her that I love her, but the point is probably moot. Cause she's watching him with those eyes, and she's loving him with that body, I just know it. And he's holding her in his arms late, late at night. You know, I wish that I had just his girl.
I'ma do me, you do you. Y'all all a bunch of haters.
I don't like the way that you talk to me when you tell me how it's gonna be. And I don't like the way that you smile at me when you tell me what is wrong with me. Sometimes I wish you'd go away. Go away and never ever come back. I don't like the mean and vindictive things you do. It makes me wanna hate on you. Yeah, it's got me sad. I'm kinda stressed. You got me feeling anxious. I'm always depressed. And I don't wanna play this game of tug of war. I
see the pyramids around their neck. I watch the sunrise from the tropic air. And just remember, darling, all the world, you belong to me. I see the marketplace in old Angier. Send me photographs and souvenirs. And just remember, when a dream appears, you belong to me. And I'll be so alone without you. Maybe you'll be lonesome too. Fly the ocean in a silver plane. See the jungle when it's wet with rain. And just remember, tell your home again, you belong to me.
We'll be right back.
All right, as you probably guessed, that was Guns and Roses. To all those opposed, well, and that's what life is. It is a jungle. You never get away from that biological substrate, much as the Catholics might like to try to transcend it with sweet lies about universal humanity, universal moralism, and all mankind being brothers. It ain't so. Not everything with a face is human, as the fascist used to say. A nigger is not the same species as a white man, and he will not be converted into a white man by the application of water mumble-jumbled over by a priest. Word. With that, let's get on to... Fucking damn thing. Let's get on to... A pièce de résistance. Actually, that's somewhat inaccurate use of that term, but I enjoy saying it, so... You'll indulge me, won't you? Today we're going to talk about anti-Semitism and thought control at Catholic University. Now, we've talked in the last couple of Radio Stinas about Thomas Heron, a row house Philly Catholic. And we've talked about the subversion of the church that raised up that young man in the 60s and 70s, how the feds bought off the upper tier Catholic institutions and some of the top Catholics who sold out for power and privilege at the cost of their 1,000-year-old tradition, or 2,000-year-old, or whatever, however old the tradition was, but certainly old, in exchange for perks and money and social respect. Tom Bethel used to write in the American Spectator about the strange new respect award, as though that were a real award given by the liberal media to right-wingers who, in the course of living and working in D.C., had become leftist. And they would garner the strange new respect award from the Washington Post as they fell in line with the Jewish agenda. Of course, Bethel, who was a traditional Catholic himself, I believe, would not put it that way. But, I mean, he wouldn't mention the specifically Jewish connection there. He would just phrase it in terms of liberalism versus conservatism. So that, you know, every incoming freshman class of Congress is trotted up to the JFK School of Government at Harvard and trained in liberalism, and most of them also were flown over to Israel at some point and encouraged to adopt the manias of that country as their own. And the hatreds of that country, too, as their own. Now we're going to talk about Jews trying to influence Catholics and succeeding in getting them to cancel a lecture series. And let me check my recording control. Okay. Where are we? Okay, let's see here. Where are we now? All right. Turning to culture war, this is from the April 2008 number, and it's an article by E. Michael Jones, and he's just going to describe what happened here, and I'll read some of this. I don't know if we'll get through it all today, but we'll go at least another 30-45 minutes. Probably end about 6:30 tonight, so we'll have gone at least 3 hours. And this is not as long as others of his articles, but I think it's highly instructive. And what we see here is the SPLC in particular trying to shut down their opponents. And they do this by calling them haters and extremists and using the power of their media and their connections and themselves being portrayed in the media run by their friends as though they're some kind of experts rather than partisans themselves. Anti-white, communist, pro-faggot, pro-pederast partisans themselves. They're portrayed as experts on hate. Hate is anyone who opposes them and their agenda, of course. And that includes everyone from the rabidest Nazi skinhead to the most cautious and scholarly Catholic intellectual, and anything in between, and anything they wish to add thereunto. So, Jones says, and I'll just do a fair amount of reading supplemented with some commentary where appropriate. Joan says, I was in the middle of a tune when I got the call. On Monday nights, I play Irish music at a pub in South Bend. I've actually been to that pub. I haven't heard him play there, but I've been to South Bend and seen that pub. It's an Irish pub, and it's filled with all kinds of happy, young, attractive white Catholics. And believe it or not, South Bend, that area, there's lots of niggers around there, a lot more than you might think. There's definitely a filthy nigger section. There's something that's particularly obnoxious about seeing niggers in a cold environment, and they're shuffling, stooping, shambling, drinking, do-nothing, holding down the corners of the porching in cold weather that is even worse than seeing them being niggers in hot weather. Cold dirty versus hot steamy dirty, I guess. Anyway, so Jones gets a call. Monday nights he plays Irish music at a pub in South Bend. On Monday, February 11th, I was planning an early departure on Tuesday morning to speak at the Catholic University School of Architecture as part of a lecture series on building Catholic communities. And this lecture series was set up in late 2007, about this time last year, Tim Ehlen, E-H-L-E-N, called to say he wanted to organize a series of lectures on the topic of building Catholic communities. He had gotten my name from Milton Grenfell, a D.C. architect, Washington, D.C., who liked my review of Notre Dame architecture professor Philip Bess's book, Till We Have Built Jerusalem, which appeared in the July-August issue of Culture Wars of 2007. My critique was based largely on the research I had done for The Slaughter of the Cities, Urban Renewal as Ethnic Cleansing, and that was, we did not discuss that book in the last two Radio Astinas, but we discussed that same phenomenon as manifest in the life of Thomas Heron, a Philadelphia row house Catholic, and the training he received at Catholic universities and in a Catholic high school. In my review, I faulted Bess for ignoring the effect that social engineering and housing had in traumatizing Catholic ethnics and driving them into the suburbs. So breaking up these row house Catholics, breaking up these ethnic parishes around the major cities, and turning the people, the flocks, into suburbanites, deracinating them, ripping them away from their religions and their racial roots, or their ethnic roots, as Jones would prefer to have it. Tim Ehlen was now on the phone explaining that the entire lecture series was canceled. So he's calling Jones up the day before he's heading out to D.C. to deliver his lecture and saying, look, it's been canceled by the Dean of the School of Architecture and Planning at Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. The architecture department was the host for this lecture series. I was scheduled to speak in less than 48 hours. This was Monday, February 11th, and the series had begun with a talk by Dr. Alan C. Carlson of the Howard Center from Rockford, Illinois. After his presentation on the question-and-answer period was over, Ehlen was called into a meeting with Dean Randall Ott and Associate Dean of Undergraduate Studies George Martin. The meeting was short and to the point. Just as Dr. Carlson was beginning his presentation, an email was sent from the Southern Poverty Law Center to Ehlen with copies to Victor Nakas, or Nakas, N-A-K-A-S, Associate Vice President of Public Affairs, and Katie Lee, Director of Public Affairs for Catholic University. The President and Provost of Catholic University were then contacted by Nakas, who in turn pulled Dean Ott, who is Lutheran, out of the presentation by Dr. Carlson to inform him of a complaint by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Quote, we were surprised that Catholic University was allowing two raging anti-Semites on their campus, unquote, Mr. Mark Potok of the center told the Washington Times, and then presumably the dean. A simple Google search will show you the frightening ideology of these men. So Potok is out there slandering and lying about these people and trying to get their lecture series canceled. That's what these leftist pederast homophobes, homophiles, Jews, and other assorted scum do in the name of tracking extremism or fighting extremism or being experts on hate or running profitable private foundations dedicated to the elimination of Christianity and white people. These are not the Latin Mass traditionalists, Mr. Potok continued, referring to me and John Sharp, who's another victim of this form of persecution, of IHS Press. These are the people, says Potok, who reject Vatican II reforms. They are out of actor Mel Gibson, Father Hutton Gibson's world in saying that the Jews are destroying the world, unquote. When confronted with the usual SPLC shtick is a Yiddish term. It means like stage act. Comes from the German word shtuch, which means piece, like in a performance piece or like a piece of ein Stück Kuchen, like a piece of cake. In Yiddish, it's shtick, properly spelled S-H-T-I-C-K. It can also be spelled with a C, but properly it's spelled S-H-T-I-C-K. When confronted with the usual SPLC shtick, that is, act, Dean Ott panicked and canceled the entire lecture series. This is how easily these people are cowed. They're supposed to fear no man, do right and fear no man, as Dr. Pierce said, but they are very afraid of most men and do whatever their bidding is. Instead of fighting their enemy, they flee from it. 6 months of effort on the part of Aylin to put the series together were all over. I would be less than candid if I were to say, says Jones, that the cancellations came as a surprise to me. The SPLC, the group which pressured CUA, Catholic University of America, to cancel, employs people whose job it is to find out when I speak and to get me canceled. This time was different, however, because the entire lecture series, which is to say 10 lectures involving at least 11 experts, covering an entire semester of talks, got canceled along with me. So, to kill the partisan, they wiped out the village. In the same issue announcing the cancellation of the lecture series, The Tower, some sort of publication, announced that Sandra Day O'Connor, the Supreme Court justice who reaffirmed the country's commitment to abortion in the Casey versus Planned Parenthood decision, is to be honored by the CUA Law School. Catholic University is going to honor a Supreme Court justice who reaffirms a pro-abortion decision. Think about that. When the Catholic Church is formally against abortion. The SPLC's action was akin to the Nazis lining everyone in the village up against the wall and shooting them because they were suspected of harboring partisans. I must have read that before and subconsciously remembered that because I didn't just read that before we started talking about it. Tactics like this rarely generated goodwill, and this instance was no exception to that rule. If the SPLC had been smart, they should have persuaded the dean to dangle the funding for the lecture series in front of the organizers and say that they could have the money if they singled out me and John Sharp. As it was, the SPLC applied its usual strong-arm tactics, the dean at CUA panicked, and the whole exercise in thought control and character assassination began to go sideways. By the time it was all over, it was clear that the SPLC had won at best a Pyrrhic victory, but that is to get ahead of my story. As its first move, the university tried to issue a meaningless statement, which seemed more intent on controlling the damage their panicky reaction had caused, rather than illuminating the situation. As Tim was scrambling to find another venue, he called D.C. public relations consultant Fran Griffin of the PR firm Griffin Communications. Fran has been a political activist since her college days at the liberal Catholic institution, Rosary College near Chicago, where she had run-ins with the campus's black student section. I mentioned her in an article last year on the Sam Francis Conference in D.C. organized by her other group, FGF Books. I think she's the one who's behind the publishing of Sobrin's newsletter, but I might be wrong about that. Tim Aylin asked, explained what had happened and asked Fran if she could help find another venue. Fran said, Tim, I can give you advice on the venue, but more urgently, can I contact the press? This is an outrage. As Tim was thinking about it, I called Fran on the other line to ask her about getting a new location. She said, Mike, let someone else take care of the venue. Can I contact the media? I told her to go ahead, and for the next 12 hours, she, at her own expense, got the word out to the press. The next thing I knew, Julia, I don't know how, D-U-I-N, Dwin or Dunn, the religion writer for the Washington Times, called me to read the statement issued by Nakus, who opined that the lecturers, referring to the entire semester's group of speakers, quote, appear to espouse views that are contrary to the mission and values of Catholic University. In light of this development, the dean of the school decided to cancel the lecture series. The damage control, it turns out, was even more damaging than the original decision. It was intended to defuse because it maligned a group of people who had no idea of why the series was canceled. What did I think of the NACUS statement? Julia Dunn wanted to know. The statement was so vague, however, that it left us both stumped as to how to proceed. After a long pause, Dunn said that she remembered my book on Medjugorje. That is the false, place in Yugoslavia where they claim to have seen Mary, which Jones, he went over there, visited it, and denounced it as a fraud, prompting me to wonder whether it was my views on apparitions that had gotten me canceled. And on that note, we ended the conversation. Tim Allen called back shortly thereafter to say he had found another venue for the talk. It was going to be held at the Catholic Information Center in downtown Washington, D.C. So my wife and I packed up the car we rented and were about to set off for Washington in the midst of a snowstorm when Julia Dunn called again. "They're saying you're an anti-Semite," she said over the phone. Dunn's call had allowed me to articulate my position for the first time in a public forum other than Culture Wars magazine. In setting in motion the chain of events that led up to this interview, Mark Potok committed a mortal sin against the first law of Jewish thought control, namely dynamic silence. That's their policy of actively trying to get newspapers and other publishers to refrain from mentioning people or books that the Jews don't want you, ordinary white man, to know about, such as the racial works of Lothrop Stoddard or Madison Grant in the first half of the 20th century. There's a famous letter online in PDF form that's a scan of a letter from the ADL going out to booksellers telling them not to stock and not to mention and not to review one of the titles by those two great men in the first half of the 20th century, famous eugenicists. So he's saying Mark Potok screwed up by turning this into a matter for the press to handle, giving Jones a forum outside of his own private magazine, Culture Wars, namely the Washington Times, which is a neocon right-wing publication. Benjamin Ginsberg revealed the existence of this dynamic silence strategy in his book Fatal Embrace. During what has come to be known as the McCarthy era, that is the early 1950s, quote from Jew Ginsberg, "the American Jewish Committee developed a strategy it called dynamic silence to combat the activities of Gerald L. K. Smith. Working together, officials of the American Jewish Committee, the American Jewish Congress, and the ADL would approach the publishers of major newspapers and owners of radio stations in cities where Smith had scheduled appearances to ask that Smith be given no coverage whatsoever. If newspapers and radio stations failed to cooperate on a voluntary basis, Jewish organizations were usually able to secure their compliance by threatening boycotts by Jewish advertisers. This strategy of dynamic silence was extremely effective in suppressing Smith and other right-wing anti-Semites." That's from Benjamin Ginsberg's The Fatal Embrace, Jews and the State, published in 1993 by the University of Chicago Press, describing the way the top Jewish organizations go around the country trying to stifle word of speeches or books by anybody who's publicly opposed to their agenda, with the backup threat of an economic boycott if they don't go along with it. Potok's intervention allowed me to tell the Washington Times that I rejected all forms of racism, and Jones is a traditional Catholic. But notice how easily he falls into using nomenclature that he would denounce elsewhere where it aims specifically against his Catholic group and his Catholic agenda as coming from a Jewish communist, therefore to be seen as agitprop rather than a legitimate word. But where the Jewish agitprop is used against white racialists, and remember that racism is the coinage of Jew Trotsky in 1920s, popularized by Jew homosexual known as sex science researcher Magnus Hirschfeld in Germany, during the Weimar days, Jones has no problem using that Jewish term without considering what it actually means. So, if he can go after Nazis by calling them racist and thereby differentiating his own school, he's more than willing to do that. It shows Jones dropping his standard, which is a little bit hypocritical, you might think. So, Podock's intervention allowed me, Jones, to tell the Washington Times that I rejected all forms of racism. Again, racism didn't exist until it was coined in the 1920s by, apparently, the Jew Trotsky. I rejected all forms of racism, including anti-Semitism, etc., etc. It also allowed me to restate what I had said at the San Francisco conference when I spoke at the National Press Club in March 2007. Heidi Beirich of the SPLC attended that talk,
but both she and Mark Podock seemed determined to make sure that no one ever got an accurate account of my position. Julia Dunn's call foiled that strategy, and her call never would have happened if Mark Podock hadn't gotten the lecture series canceled. So Jones is essentially saying that Jewish queers and pederasts are not very good at their job. They did get the lecture series canceled, but they still gave him an opportunity to get the word out in a broader forum that would have been achieved by the lecture alone, had he been able to deliver it as scheduled. This was the first of many times during the next few days when the statement of Joseph to his brothers would pop into my mind. The evil you intended to do to me, Joseph said to the brothers who had betrayed him, has been turned by God's power into good. And so, because of Mr. Podock's intervention, I was allowed to say in a major D.C. newspaper that I found the cancellation outrageous. I was further allowed to say, quote, we were Catholics talking to other Catholics about community. The SPLC has veto power over what Catholics say to each other, all because of the cowards at Catholic University. Don't you think they owed me the courtesy of at least calling me up? Wasn't there any due process here? And very good of Jones to call them exactly what they are. They're cowards. Sellouts, cowards, and appeasers is what we need to be calling those of our own who advance the Jewish agenda over the bodies, literally over the bodies of their own people. The sliced, diced up, unborn white children make Ann Coulter money. They make Rush Limbaugh rich. They make Sean Hannity successful. As long as he advocates in line with what the Jews want, everything's fine. And they live the good life, while the rest of whites, their own race, suffer. And I was allowed to say, says Jones, everything I have said is totally consistent with the teachings of the Catholic Church. There is nothing anti-Semitic about anything I have ever said, and I reject racism. Now, we have our own problems with that, but this is what he's saying to the Washington Times. As I said, I would have no form to say any of this anywhere outside of the Culture Wars magazine without the intervention of Mark Podock. So thank you, Mr. Podock. My statements in the Washington Times put Catholic University in a bind because now both Victor Nakas and Dean Randall Ott had gone on record as banning a Catholic from speaking at the Bishop's University for articulating the Catholic position in a book which did not figure into the conference at all, as well as banning 9 other speakers whose position had nothing whatever to do with Mark Podock's grievance. They had also gone on record in preventing me from articulating a position on Catholic community drawn from another book, The Slaughter of the Cities, which had nothing whatsoever to do with Jews. Well, at least as far as he knows. All in all, it was a red-letter day in the history of academic freedom in America. And now he's going to go into the liberalism of some of these Catholic cowards and point out just how non-Catholic they really are. They've kept the name, but they've swapped the contents. It's the old Zelensky-Callahan thing from Tommy Boy. Inferior Jewish ideas in an Aryan box, a proud Aryan box, a noble Aryan box, a respected, honored Aryan box containing Jewish crap. Says Catholic University, but the stuff inside is Jewish. Selling out means hiring Jewish professors to vend Jewish lies, spread Jewish nostrums, bad medicine for Goyim, teach them lies, but they're au courant. They're with the times, they're in the spirit of the zeitgeist. They will move us up in the world. All we have to do is sell out our traditions and our soul. Victor Nakas, it turned out, had already articulated Catholic University speaker's policy in a way that supported my position and should have protected me from Mark Podock's attack. In September 2007, Meg Jalsevac, J-A-L-S-E-V-A-C, writing for LifeSiteNews.com, reported that the college Democrats had received permission to invite pro-abortion Senator John Kerry to lecture at the university in what seemed like a deliberate defiance of the U.S. bishop's ban on allowing Catholic institutions to promote abortion. So here you have the Catholic Church is against abortion, but these universities that are named the Catholic University of America, places where they're training their bishops and they're training their priests and the various different names they go by, they're allowing all of these people who espouse anti-Catholic positions to come and speak and be given awards and treated with great respect. This seeming contradiction, however, was no match for the dialectical skills of Victor Nakas, who explained to Jalsevac that a Carey lecture at CUA would not be a contradiction to the USCCB policy because, quote, we verified with the bishops themselves that the intent of the statement was to refuse a platform to speakers who would be invited to speak on those specific issues for which they hold positions that are at variance with the fundamental moral teachings of the Catholic Church. He continued, this means, for example, that we would be violating the letter and the intent of the bishop's statement were we to invite Senator Carey to speak on abortion. However, we would not be violating the letter and the spirit of the bishop's statement were we to permit the College Democrats to invite Senator Carey to speak on the environment or the Iraq war. So he can speak here as long as he's not talking about the issue on which he's against the position of the church. So according to the principles articulated by Nakus himself, I should have been allowed to speak because the topic which I had been invited to talk about, building Catholic communities, had nothing to do with the issues Mark Podock raised, namely his supposed anti-Semitism. Beyond that, my views on the Jews are totally consistent with the teachings of the Church in a way that Carey's views on abortion are not, so they should not have disqualified me from speaking in any case. This is, of course, a fortiori, even more strongly true for the other 10 speakers who got canceled along with me, who had never even heard of my views and probably never even heard of me either. By now it should be obvious that any sense of principle or due process goes out the window the moment anyone raises the issue of anti-Semitism. This is the ultimate taboo in our culture, and the people at the SBLC are fully aware of this fact and exploit the situation as a way of silencing the people that they want silenced. Podock has learned from experience that he has maximal leverage at the places which proclaim their commitment to academic freedom the loudest, which is to say academe in general and Catholic academe in particular. The incident also shows the parlous state of Catholic higher education in America 41 years after Land O'Lakes, when Reverend Theodore Hesburgh, CSC, stole Notre Dame from the Catholic Church. Hesburgh was loud in proclaiming academic freedom as the justification of his theft of church property. No institution outside of the university, he proclaimed, can dictate policy at an institution like the newly liberated University of Notre Dame. Hesburgh, of course, had coupled his defiance of Rome and Catholic doctrine with a policy of opening the University of Notre Dame to control by the highest bidder. He's selling out when it came to foundation and government money. 4 years before he issued his Land O'Lakes Manifesto, that's a place where they held a meeting of some of the Catholic hierarchy in America, and in which they agreed to sell out their principles and their tradition in exchange for foundation and government grant money. 4 years before that Land O'Lakes meeting, Hesburgh had arranged with John D. Rockefeller III's Population Council to sponsor a series of secret conferences whose purpose was to get Catholic theologians to undermine the Church's teaching on contraception. As part of the negotiations leading up to those conferences, paid for by the Rockefeller money, Hesburgh agreed to subject the speakers list, the topics list, and even the books that got put out in the literature tables to Population Council approval. As his reward for groveling for Rockefeller money, Hesburgh was given the AAUP's Michael John Award for promoting academic freedom 1 year later. So again, the Jew tends to present things not merely by misleading terms, but by the opposite. The most misleading term of all is to call a thing by the opposite of what it really is. So it's not academic freedom, it's selling out. It's subversion rather than freedom. Hesburgh's betrayal of both Catholic principle and the principle of academic freedom has led to the current situation at Catholic colleges across the United States. According to this view, any attempt to undermine Catholic sexual morality is automatically defended as a courageous form of free speech, which is protected by academic freedom. On the other hand, any time someone like Mark Podock and the SBLC raises the specter of anti-Semitism, all of the normal talk about academic freedom ceases, due process is suspended, and the speaker is banned within minutes of the charge being raised, even if the topics he is going to speak on have nothing to do with the Jews. The new wrinkle added by Catholic U is that now anyone in the same lecture series can be banned as well. So, gutlessness is the gift that keeps on giving. Knock over one domino, it knocks over the rest of them. If you can't criticize what Jews are doing, pretty soon you can't talk about Jews having interests at all. Pretty soon you can't even mention the word Jews. pretty soon even thinking itself is anti-Semitic. Pretty soon even your own existence as a free person is problematic for the Jews. There is nothing that will satisfy the Jews except white disappearance from the face of the earth. That's the truth of the matter. When CUA President Daniel M. O'Connell meets with Notre Dame professors in private, he likes to brag about how Orthodox and Catholic his university is in comparison to theirs. However, the recent cancellation of the Building Catholic Communities lecture series at CUA, Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., CUA, shows there is no essential difference between these universities when it comes to compromising both academic freedom and the Catholic character of the university when subjected to pressure by groups like the SPLC. Father O'Connell, in fact, espouses what might be called the Jenkins Doctrine of academic freedom. Vagina monologues, yes. Oberammergau, no. Vagina monologues is a feminist, Jewish feminist play that's put on a lot of different places. It's utterly, absurdly ridiculous, as you can tell from the name. Feminist agitprop, feminist ideology. Whereas Oberammergau is a place in Germany where they put on the Passion Play. Passion Play being the story of Christ's crucifixion. And the Jews have always hated that. It has something to do with Wagner and German tradition over there, and the Jews have always hated that and wanted to renounce it because it shows Jews are the ones who murdered Christ. And the Jews like to stick in their movies. A cop, did you know that Jesus was a Jew? You find that popping up all over the place now in the last few years, including I earlier referred to one of the movies by Kevin Smith, Mallrats, and the shopping agenda remark by the Ben Affleck character purely for the humor in it. But in another movie, the same two stoners featured in Mallrats, Silent Bob and I forget the J character's name, but in one of them, I think the man who wrote and produced that movie, Kevin Smith, is a believing Catholic. But he's pretty liberal, and he had Alanis Morissette play God in one of his movies, Dogma. And he first came to fame for his movie Clerks, featuring the stoner Jay and Silent Bob. Jay is the stoner, and in Clerks 2, I think it was, he has a stoner character, Jay, saying to this other guy, did you know that Jesus was a Jew? And I just noticed that particular meme pops up in the weirdest places. And it's clearly stuck in there by Hollywood as a way of indemnifying Jews against righteous anger against them that might have been engendered by the Mel Gibson movie, showing just how horrible the crucifixion really was and just what rotters the Jews actually were, although Gibson, far from underlining that, actually bent over backwards to make it more look like the Romans were the bad guys. But of course, anything that isn't 150% positive about Jews is taken as direst anti-Semitism. So you understand what I'm saying. Once you're sensitive to these things and you're alert to them, you can spot them just everywhere in the pseudo-culture the Jews have prepared for us, in which nothing is organic or real and everything is made to conform. Everything is Semitized for the Jews' protection. Maybe some of you younger people don't even know what that's a takeoff on. Sanitized for your protection is like a slip you might see. Not sure if over a toilet seat in a hotel, but certainly over a hanger as your return clothes that you brought in to be dry cleaned, sanitized for your protection, Semitized for Jews' protection. They've safely lopped it of any balls it might have, anything that might put the white seed in your mind, might irrigate you and let you grow fertile as you realize how you've been lied to all these years. I'm giving the white perspective, and we're talking about a Catholic traditionalist facing the same problems that we face as whites when we try to speak openly about what the Jews are doing to us and our people and our ways of living and our traditions, our kind. So Jones is saying that Catholic universities are pretending to be traditional and Orthodox, but in reality they're acceding to Jewish pressure, they're conforming to Jewish policy, and they're saying yes to vagina monologues and no to the Oberammergau Passion Play. And he's calling that the Jenkins Doctrine. The doctrine gets its name from the hapless president of Notre Dame University, Reverend John Jenkins, CSC, who as one of his first acts in office articulated a position on academic freedom which would allow the performance of the obscene vagina monologues, but which would ban a performance of the Oberammergau passion play. Again, Oberammergau is a village in Germany in which traditionally this play has been carried on, I think every year or at least every few years. And the passion of Jesus Christ is the story of his ascent from station to station on the way to being crucified, as depicted in Mel Gibson's film. Which group thinks that obscenity is a protected form of expression but passion plays are not? If your answer to that question was the Jews, you have come a long way to understanding how commissars, that is political police, the old Soviet Union, a commissar was someone who was attached to an army unit to ensure its ideological uniformity, typically a Jew, because the USSR was a Jewish production. So he's calling Mark Podock a commissar. If you understand the answer to that question was Jews, you've come a long way to understanding how commissars like Mark Podock can impose Jewish forms of political correctness, and he should say Semitical correctness, on Catholic institutions like CUA and Notre Dame. In his book, The Jewish Century, Yuri Slezkin opined that in becoming moderns, we had all become Jewish. The same verdict applies a fortiori even more strongly to Catholic academe in America. Combine the internalization of Jewish values that Slezkin mentioned as manifest in the mind of John Jenkins, head of Notre Dame, with the normal intellectual cowardice that one finds in Catholic academics and administrators, and you will find a situation where Catholics are eager to denounce other Catholics in a way that would make Stasi informers blush with shame. Stasi being the late East German security apparatus, the NKVD, the KGB of East Germany. Notre Dame was embroiled in a controversy of its own at the same time the Building Catholic Communities Conference was banned at CUA. In early February, a delegation of bishops refused to meet at Notre Dame because the vagina monologues was scheduled to be performed there. This brought about a 2.5-hour meeting between Jenkins and the Most Reverend John M. Darcy, ordinary of the Diocese of Fort Wayne, South Bend, during which Jenkins refused to budge, claiming that if the issue were anti-Semitism, he would have acted with alacrity, a cheerful briskness. Jenkins' refusal has precipitated a crisis at Notre Dame. Bishop Daniel Jenke, J-E-N-K-Y, is threatening to resign from the board, which would probably lead to the resignation of Jenkins less than a third of the way into his term as president. When I mentioned the vagina monologues to the student reporter who was sent to cover my talk, which eventually got held at the originally scheduled time but a different location, Catholic Information Center on K Street, he informed me that it had not been allowed to be performed on the CUA campus. Before President O'Connell, who is rumored to be Bishop Darcy's successor, uses this fact as an excuse to run to the front of the synagogue and proclaim that he is, quote, not like the rest of the men, quote, it is worth noting that the CUA variant of the vagina monologues is Antonella Barba. So I guess Jones is saying that CUA is claimed to be Orthodox, but it allows Antonella Barba to carry on, although it does ban the vagina monologues. For the uninitiated, which is to say for the few people out there who do not watch TV, Antonella Barba is a student in the CUA School of Architecture who competed on American Idol and can be seen, if you remove the safe search from your search engine, at various national monuments in various stages of undress, engaging in various forms of sexual activity. She also attempted to get other CUA co-eds to pose naked for a CUA calendar. And see, this is what passes for edgy. She's conforming to the Jewish agenda, and in return they reward her by calling her edgy, just as they reward these chumps and sellouts like Hesburgh by calling them promoters and defenders of academic freedom, when in fact they're traitors to their own people, their own kind, their own religious tradition. There are always people willing to sell out. This caused a scandal among CUA students, many of whom felt her behavior contradicted the Catholic nature of the university and wanted the university to do something. Instead of reprimanding her, CUA responded in February 2007 by issuing a press release encouraging friends and fellow CUA students to gather in front of the Edward J. Prisbola University Center for viewings of the live episodes that feature Barbara. So, being on TV is it's better than anything else. It's a higher value than anything else. You're only real if you're on TV. We'll throw out our 2,000-year-old tradition and history and moral teachings in order to promote one of our own because she's on TV. Therefore famous, therefore good. So the administration is promoting, dare I say, pimping, as all the whites who think they're talking like niggers like to say nowadays. They're pimping their own student, promoting her appearances. What's she famous for? Well, being famous. Engaging in forms of Jew-favored promiscuity, sexual looseness, particularly valuable because she's in the position of being a student at a Catholic university. She's particularly valuable to the Jews as someone who can undermine it. And here is the head of the Catholic university playing right along with it. So the university administration puts out a press release encouraging CUA faculty and students to join them in a group watching of American Idol on which one of their students is featured. And she was presumably wearing most of her clothes and not performing fellatio at the time, says Jones, taking a nice little dart at her. Barbara, CUA students were told in the same press release, will next perform, that word again, Wednesday, February 21st on Fox. The lowest male and female vote-getters will be eliminated from the competition during a live show on February 22nd on Fox. For now, Fantanellas, I guess that's fans of Antonella Barba, can show their support for Barbara on the website antonella-barbara.org, one of three internet sites that have already cropped up to keep tabs on Barbara's trek toward singer stardom. This is just one more instance, says Jones, of the Jenkins Doctrine. Vagina Monologue C, Oberammergau 9. His doctrine alive and well on the campus, is what he's saying. Yes to vagina monologues, no to the passion play. Yes to Jewish feminism, no to Jesus and moral traditionalism. By acquiescing to the SPLC's demands, Catholic University was also acquiescing to the speech code it is the SPLC's mission to enforce. That is, thought suppression. They're thought police. They don't want anyone thinking things, let alone doing anything. At this point, it is worth pondering the speech code to which Victor Nakas and Randall Ott have committed all of us, Catholics in particular. According to that code, anyone who's ever said anything that Mark Podock of the SPLC or Abe Foxman of the ADL finds offensive will never be allowed to speak anywhere on any topic whatsoever, ever again. In addition to that, anyone associated with that person will also be prohibited from speaking as well, even if they have never met or heard of the person in question, the person who incurred the wrath of the SPLC or the ADL in the first place. What Nakas and Ott failed to explain is how this draconian code is compatible with American principle, church teachings, or academic freedom. The cancellation of the lecture series on building Catholic communities exposed the speech code under which all of us now live in its totalitarian malignity. It is not enforced by any law or any government agency. Its force depends on the cowardice and lack of solidarity of those who capitulate to it. As long as the Jews can pick us off as individuals, as long as we aren't loyal to ourselves, our group, and our team, they are going to continue to win, and we're going to have to grovel and be denied outlets to do and act in our best interest. So we have to join together. We have to band and fight the Jews as one. Otherwise, we'll all remember that Franklin cartoon, Revolutionary War, the cut-up snake, the different section of the snake being the different colonies. Join or die was what they wrote beneath that. We must all hang together, or we will all hang separately. That's how it is today for whites against the Jews, including our white Catholic brothers. The reaction which followed the cancellation was a tacit admission that Catholic University had not only reneged on its commitment to academic freedom, it had, out of cowardice, acquiesced to a speech code so draconian that it inspired outrage in virtually everyone who commented on it, such as me, who's not a Catholic. Shortly after the news of the cancellation appeared on the SPLC website, Carl Gethman wrote to President O'Connell, quote, "I am amazed," unquote, Gethman wrote, "that your university would cancel a lecture series by Dr. E. Michael Jones and by Mr. John Sharp on the mere say-so of the Southern Poverty Law Center. SPLC is a virulently anti-Catholic organization who, while presenting themselves as defenders of Negroes, has done little or nothing for them. In point of fact, if you examine the activities of the SPLC, you find that they spend most of their funds and energies in defending the state of Israel. SPLC has made it a major thrust of their policy to destroy the careers and lives of anyone who criticizes the policies of the state of Israel and the war in Iraq. Why your university caved into the SPLC's totally unsupported charge of anti-Semitism against these two outstanding gentlemen is beyond my comprehension, an absolute disgrace, especially since you gave neither of them a chance to defend themselves against these spurious charges. It appears that in this country, all anyone has to say to silence someone whose opinions they do not agree with is to accuse them of being an anti-Semite or a racist. No one bothers to look into whether or not these accusations are accurate." Of course, the assumption there is that that anti-Semitism, anti-Semites, racists, and racism do exist and are inherently bad things. So the actual problem is deeper than what this letter writer he's quoting says. Anti-Semitism is just a dirty word for someone who understands the nature of the Jew and fights back against it. Racism is just a dirty word for a white. Just anti-Semitism is just a dirty word for beliefs held by a non-Jew. Anti-Semite's a non-Jew. Racist is a white. There is no separation of... There is no check whether the charges are valid. The charges are inherently invalid. The charges are just that. They're charges. They don't like you, and they won't reveal the grounds on which they dislike you, which are racial. They're not about what you said. They're about your existence. Podok doesn't think white people should exist. "I have read," continuing to quote this Gethman, who I'm unfamiliar with, "I have read most of the writings of both of these gentlemen, that is Jones and Sharp, and I can assure they are both honorable and truthful men who thoroughly and accurately document everything they write. Unfortunately for them, they both oppose Israeli policies and the unjust war in Iraq, which by any measure has been probably the biggest foreign policy blunder in our history." And I'm not sure what he's talking about there, because I really haven't seen SPLC write anything about the war in Iraq. They mostly stick to attacking honest white men and defending criminal niggers, Jewish sex perverts, non-Jewish sex perverts, and illegal Mexicans. I haven't seen them talk about the war in Israel at all. He says, Gethman, "I protest most vigorously against your university's cancellation of their lecture series. It seems that you have a problem with the political views of people who defend the church and its magisterial teachings, but do not seem to have a problem inviting speakers to your university who belittle, denigrate, and oppose the tenets and dogmas of the Roman Catholic faith. I strongly suggest that you have your priorities backwards. I will pray for you and the administrators of your university that when the next moment of decision occurs, that you will make the proper decision and stand up for what is right and not for what is expedient." So I guess he's going to pray that a coward turns into a brave man, or a rabbit turns into a lion. A rabbit heart turns into a lion heart. Not very often. "By February 15th, Friday, the tide had turned," says Jones, "and by this point all the publicity was running in favor of the band speakers and against the SPLC and the CUA administration. Tim Allen's determination to find another venue, plus the speaker's willingness to go on in spite of the cancellation, plus Fran Griffin's press release, plus the willingness of the Catholic Information Center to accommodate the lecture on short notice, plus Julia Dunn's article in the Washington Times, had turned a lecture series that probably would have been ignored into a news story which had taken on a life of its own. Friday afternoon, the Barbara Hollingsworth, local opinion editor of the Examiner, ran an article on the cancellation on her blog, Sharp Sticks, which meant more bad news for the SPLC. In response to the SPLC claim that I was a raging anti-Semite, Hollingsworth Googled Jones and came up with an October 2006 article, The Conversion of the Revolutionary Jew, about which she wrote, Jones believes in converting Jews to Christianity, a highly politically incorrect view also held by Pope Benedict XVI. But in the same article, he says, the church is not and cannot possibly be anti-Semitic because the term primarily refers to race and racial hatred. The church cannot promote racial hatred of any group, certainly not of the Jews, because its founder was a member of that racial group. Of course, Jones doesn't know that for a fact. He's simply asserting it. Anti-Semitism, if by that term we mean hatred of the Jews, because of immutable and ineradicable racial characteristics, is wrong. So Jones is denying biology right there, just as Peter denied Christ under pressure. Jones, under pressure, is denying that Jews are racially different from whites, even though the facts say otherwise. But the Catholics are free to avoid the facts because biological facts cast doubt on the efficacy of the sacraments, namely the sacrament of baptism, which says that when you sprinkle water on a Jew and mumble some holy words over it, it changes from a Jew into a Catholic. Not just nominally, but through its entire being. Ridiculous, but they wouldn't be religious if they weren't ridiculous, would they? Hollingsworth's claim raises an interesting point. If a simple Google search, to use Mark Poduck's phrase, made my views clear to Barbara Hollingsworth, why didn't Nakus and Ott make the minimal attempt at research before they canceled the lecture series? Do the administrators at Catholic University know how to do Google searches on their computers? Do they know how to read? Hollingsworth's article continued. Hollingsworth's article continued in the same vein. Jones categorically denies being anti-Semitic. That's not true, he says. I wrote a theological book on the Jews, the Jewish revolutionary spirit, that Mr. Poduck doesn't like, he told me. The dean at CUA didn't bother to call anybody before pulling the rug totally out from under us. Hollingsworth then got to the double standard which lies at the heart of anti-Semitism as a form of thought control practiced by groups like the SPLC. The goyim are punished for quoting Jews, or as Hollingsworth put it, to make things even more confusing, an article published in the 2004 Jewish Quarterly entitled Triple Ethnics, or Triple Ethnics, E-X-T-H-N-I-C-S, Jews in the American Porn Industry, by the author Nathan Abrams, raises one of the same points Byrick accuses Jones of making. Does that mean that Abrams is a raging anti-Semite too? So, you're an anti-Semite if you say the same thing about Jews that Jews say about you or them in their own private publications. So basically you're an anti-Semite no matter what you say or do. You're an anti-Semite by virtue of what you are. This is the point that Jones denies, but which we as white nationalists, free of the dogma of the church, the anti-biological, anti-racist dogma of the Catholic Church, are free to observe. Namely, Jews are a different species from whites. That's why wherever you find Jews and whites living together, they're at odds. Well, the goy don't even really pay attention to Jews much more than a dog pays attention to its fleas or its leeches or its ticks. But both of them are different biological entities. Hollingsworth failed to mention that the Abrams article presents a new wrinkle in the anti-Semitism as a political control story. Abrams lifted essentially his entire article from my piece on Jewish involvement in pornography, Rabbi Dresner's Dilemma. That's E. Michael Jones' article on Jews and pornography, and a Jew copied a lot of that into a Jewish publication. So it's anti-Semitism when Jones does it, but it's perfectly fine when a Jew does it. A Jew writes about Jews in porn. Perhaps more than... let me see here. Let me see how much farther we have to go. We've gone 3 hours, and 8 hours last time was too much. It started to work in my voice at the end. Let's see what page... I think we can keep going to the end. We got about 5 more pages of his article to go. Boy, he's got a good photo of Poduck, and you can just see what a diseased fuck he is from the look in his eyes. He looks like a troubled little faggot. In his article on Jews and porn, Jones quoted, I quoted Al Goldstein, who said that Jews were involved in pornography because, quote unquote, Christ sucks. And I was termed an anti-Semite for quoting him. But then Abrams quotes me and presumably uses his article which makes essentially the same points as mine, as a reason for raise and tenure for his academic sinecure. Whereas my article, The Source of Abrams' Ideas, gets me banned from Catholic University. So the Jew is essentially, if not plagiarizing, he's stealing the main ideas of Jones's work, repeating them in a slightly different form, and using that as a basis to go for his own sinecure, his own cushy position, his own raise and his tenure. Whereas the same ideas are used to prevent Jones from speaking at Catholic University. It gets even more complicated. Hollingsworth then brings up the fact that, quote, in David Horowitz's Front Page magazine, former Boston Herald writer Don Fader, a Jew himself, says he was slimed by the SPLC and that the radical group makes the Anti-Defamation League and the ACLU seem nuanced, objective, and calm by comparison, unquote. This brings up another interesting point. A simple Google search, as Mark Podock puts it, would have revealed not only my views, it would also have revealed the unsavory history of the Southern Poverty Law Center and its history of exploiting black misery for financial gain, as revealed in Ken Silverstein's November 2000 article in Harper's Magazine, The Church of Morris Dees, How the Southern Poverty Law Center Profits from Intolerance. Again, the same questions arise. Do the administrators at Catholic University know what a search engine is? Have they heard about Google? Do they know how to read? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, and if Nakus and Ott had spent another 5 minutes of their valuable time on the computer before canceling the entire Building Catholic Communities lecture series, they might have learned that, quote, the SPLC's other important work, Justice, consists mainly in spying on private citizens who belong to, quote-unquote, hate groups, sharing its files with law enforcement agencies, and suing the most prominent of these groups for crimes committed independently by their members. A practice that, however seemingly justified, should give civil libertarians pause. They might also have learned that, quote, the American Institute of Philanthropy gives the center of the SPLC one of the worst ratings of any group it monitors, estimating that the SPLC could operate for 4.6 years without making another tax-exempt nickel from its investments or raising another tax-deductible cent from well-meaning people like you. That is, they have about $120 million in the bank, and they spend very, very little of that pursuing their stated aims. They might also have learned, says Jones, that attorney Gloria Brown resigned from the SPLC after concluding that, quote, the center's programs were calculated to cash in on black pain and white guilt. A good example of that occurred in 1987 when the SPLC won a $7 million judgment against the United Klans of America on behalf of Beulah McDonald, whose son was lynched by two Klansmen. The UKA's total assets amounted to a warehouse whose sale netted Mrs. Donald $51,875. According to a groundbreaking series published in the Montgomery Advertiser, the SPLC made $9 million from fundraising solicitations featuring the case, including one containing a photo of Michael Donald's corpse. Nelson Algren once said that every movement begins as a cause, becomes a business, and ends up as a racket. The SPLC is the civil rights movement as a racket. It is notorious among legitimate civil rights groups like the Atlanta-based Southern Center for Human Rights, which handles several dozen death penalty cases a year. You are a fraud and a con man, the Southern Center's director, Stephen Bright, wrote in a 1996 letter to SPLC Southern Poverty Law Center director Morris Dees, and proceeded to list his many reasons for thinking so, which included, quote, your failure to respond to the most desperate needs of the poor and powerless, despite your millions upon millions, your fundraising techniques, the fact that you spend so much, accomplish so little, and promote yourselves so shamelessly. The left, as well as the heirs of the civil rights movement, all consider Morris Dees and the SPLC a fraud. Apparently the only people who don't know this about the SPLC are the deans and professors at Catholic universities, who are so busy denouncing other Catholics that they can't find the time to find out what everyone else already knows with the benefit of what Mark Podock calls a simple Google search. Writing in the New York Press in 2007, the British left-wing journalist Alexander Coburn wrote, I've long regarded Morris Dees and the Southern Poverty Law Center as collectively one of the greatest frauds in American life. The reasons? A relentless fundraising machine devoted to terrifying its mostly low-income contributors into unbelting ill-spared dollars year after year to an organization that now has an endowment of more than $100 million, with very little to show for it beyond hysterical bulletins designed to raise money on the proposition that only the SPLC can stop Nazism and the KKK from seizing power. Given this much evidence so easily available, Dean Ott's snap decision to cancel the lecture series amounts to actionable negligence. That simple Google search led reporter Barbara Hollingsworth to formulate the questions which Professors Nakas and Ott should have raised before they acted so precipitously, namely, are Jones and Sharp raging anti-Semites who should not be allowed to speak on any Catholic campus, even on a topic that has nothing whatsoever to do with Jews? If they are, the SPLC hasn't proved it beyond a reasonable doubt. All of the citations the group provided were SPLC's interpretation of what the two men supposedly espoused, not their own words. Accusing somebody of being a raging anti-Semite is a very serious charge. Actually, it's not a serious charge at all. But that's where we and Jones disagree. Those who make it should be required to provide irrefutable proof. So far, the SPLC hasn't, so it's impossible for an objective observer to tell whether the accusations against the two men are true or whether the SPLC is just using them as fodder for its next direct mail broadside. That being the case, shouldn't the benefit of the doubt be in favor of free speech? I tried to ask CUA officials this question, but they didn't return my call. That's not Jones, that's the woman he's quoting. University administrators, she goes on, are supposed to be defenders of academic freedom, which by definition is the right to pursue even highly unpopular topics, because if everybody agreed with everybody else, protecting speech would not be necessary. By kicking the lecture series on Catholic communities off campus without irrefutable proof that the two panelists are guilty as charged, CUA officials not only betrayed them, but their own educational mission as well. On the same day, says Jones, that Barbara Hollingsworth's piece appeared on the Examiner website, and I'm not familiar with the Examiner or the website, Ryan J. Riley's piece on the cancellation appeared in The Tower, the CUA student newspaper. Riley was the student reporter who had interviewed me the night of my talk at the Catholic Information Center. His article could not have made Mark Podock happy either. Tim Allen got to label the SPLC as an anti-Catholic, pro-Israel group that is extremely well-funded and fights dirty. Riley portrayed Dean Ott as hiding out in the tall grass. Calls to Ott were transferred to the Office of Public Affairs, which had no further comment. And Jones got to address the anti-Semitism charges on his own terms. And this is Jones quoting himself. Under the subtitle in this article, Rejection of Logos, or Logos. Jesus Christ came to earth as the Messiah. When he arrived on earth, the Jews had to make a choice. They could either accept him or they could reject him, said Jones. The further premise of the book is that when Jews rejected Jesus Christ, they rejected Logos. Christ is the Logos, the order of the universe. And when they rejected Logos, they became revolutionaries. Jones, Riley continued, said his views are consistent with the Catholic faith and found it outrageous that he could not say it at Catholic University. It is outrageous that this dean will listen to this group of racketeers and not give me the courtesy of asking me, is this true? Said Jones. It is total intellectual cowardice on this man's part. We are trying to articulate the basis for Catholic community. Catholic U should be ashamed of itself for turning its back on its own people. Jones, and this is a quote from the magazine article in the student paper at Catholic University where the president forbid Jones from speaking and canceled the lecture series. Jones said that Catholic academia is full of hypocrisy and called for solidarity amongst Catholics. A graduate student who attended the speech said it was a shame that the lecture was taken off campus because the issues discussed are very important to the issues that many majors deal with, architecture, law, theology, and so on. He said that the SPLC labels as an anti-Semite anyone who believes that Judaism as a religion is insufficient. The lies propagated by the SPLC should be rejected instead of the school caving into them, said the student, who wished to remain anonymous. The responses to the article were even more hostile to the SPLC, says Jones. Where is the liberal outrage that we saw when Stanley Tucci was barred from campus, wondered Jimmy. Does the fact that the SPLC is labeling Dr. Jones an anti-Semite make him an anti-Semite? Jimmy continued, especially when he denies the charge. Shouldn't he have been given equal opportunity to defend himself? Or are bureaucrats like Randall Ott so afraid of being slandered with the SPLC's brush that they can't take the time to do their due diligence? Do we actually take the claims of the SPLC's blog at face value, or do we investigate them? They cite a number of headlines as, quote, hateful, quote, unquote, that I for the life of me don't understand and couldn't understand without the articles. Did they actually read the articles, or take the information at face value? What's next? Do we not allow Mel Gibson to speak because the ADL doesn't like the Passion of the Christ? Do we ban the Pope because the ADL doesn't like his revision of the Good Friday prayer? I find it very strange that we would allow an organization so affiliated with the extreme left to determine who is and who is not in communion with the Holy See. Surely if the issue is one of Catholicity, it should be determined by competent ecclesiastical authorities, such as the Archbishop of Washington or the Bishop of Fort Wayne South Bend, not PR flacks like Victor Nakas or bureaucrats like Randall Ott. That's all the letter from Jimmy appearing in the Tower, the student publication at Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. Jimmy made a crucial point here, says Jones. Who gets to determine policy and doctrine at the Bishop's University in America? Well, just like who gets to determine what's good for white people and what white people are and what they mean as a race? Jews or whites themselves? Jews or Catholics themselves? Unlike Notre Dame, Catholic University is a pontifical institution run by the United States bishops. Can this nation's bishops articulate their position at their own university, or will they continue to cave into pressure by groups like the SPLC by accepting, at least tacitly, if not explicitly, their definition of anti-Semitism and all of the political control that goes along with it? Is the Gospel of St. John anti-Semitic? Do the nation's bishops have to accept the verdict of the SPLC or the ADL on that question too? If not, why do those groups get to determine the speaker's policy at the Bishop's University? Again, this is Jews telling Catholics what they're allowed to believe, who they're allowed to invite to speak, who they're allowed to listen to. In fact, it's telling them what they must believe. Who died and made the Jews boss? Who died and made the Judeo-Bolsheviks, these hate-filled Jewish pederasts and leftists, the boss of what is said and believed at a Catholic university? Think about how ridiculous and outrageous that is. These same whites try to dictate to us whites. They try to say who we are and define us to our own children in the publications used in our schools. Think about that. Says Jones, this lack of an agreed-upon definition of anti-Semitism plagued the blog discussions of the incident. But, of course, anti-Semitism has no definition because that would hinder its meaning. There'd be a way to find out what it objectively means and apply it to people. Instead, it's simply used to blow people up. Its function is to inhibit people in the same way that a mortar shell inhibits people, by killing them, whether directly and physically or by assassinating their reputation. The discussion on the blogs revolved for the most part around a semantic issue. No one took the time to define anti-Semitism, and so no one knew what the other side meant when it used the term. Bloggers like Mark seem to be working from the SPLC's definition of the term, which meant someone who talks about Jews in a way that Jews like Mark Podock do not like. On the SPLC website, Mark Podock accused me of being a, quote, raging anti-Semite, unquote. As evidence, he cited, quote, the magazine's cover stories, which give a flavor of its message. Judaizing, then and now. The Converso problem, then and now. The Judaism of Hitler. Shylock comes to Notre Dame, and so on. That sounds interesting, the Judaism of Hitler. I'd like to read that myself. I'm sure I know what line he takes, but if anyone's got a copy of that, please send that to me, the Judaism of Hitler, because I have not read that. I'm sure he'll say that Hitler took a racial view of Jews just as the Jews take of themselves, and that both are wrong and that Catholics are right, and that it's not a racial biological matter but a soul free will matter. This indicates Podock's definition of anti-Semitism as well as his bind. According to his definition, anyone who mentions Jews is ipso facto an anti-Semite. Shylock comes to Notre Dame is therefore prima facie evidence supporting his claim. This also indicates his bind. If he tells the truth, he is spreading my message. If he lies, he's going to be found out. Both things happened as a result of the cancellation of the CUA lecture series. Hundreds of people who otherwise never would have heard of me went to the Culture Wars website and read what I had to say, as opposed to the words Podoc was putting in my mouth. In doing so, they discovered that Shylock Comes to Notre Dame was about a performance of The Merchant of Venice on the campus, on that campus, and the discussion which ensued. The SBLC attack allowed me to make more forcefully the points I made in my review of Till We Have Built Jerusalem, which is, I guess, a book, points which I intended to make on the CUA campus as well. What Professor Best calls the Tocqueville option, i.e., that an essentially benign American culture can bring about the assimilation and amalgamation of disparate ethnic groups, is no longer a viable option. The actions of the SPLC show that the war on the Catholic community, which began with the government orchestration of the black migration into Catholic parishes, like St. Louis the King Parish in Detroit, and proceeded to include busing as a way of destroying Southie in Boston, and culminated in the destruction of Pole Town, all of which I have documented in The Slaughter of the Cities, continues to this day. As I showed in that book, The Slaughter of the Cities, this campaign had always been delegated to certain non-governmental groups which enjoyed government favor. The American Friends Service Committee and the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, sent spies into bars on the south side of Chicago in the 50s. Alexander Coburn's account of the SPLC's recent attack on the anti-globalization movement lends credence to this suspicion. At some point in their relentless quest for terrifying specters with which to coax the money out of the pockets of the suckers, as Coburn puts it, the SPLC declared war on the environmentalist, claiming in their newsletters that they, quote, pine for nations of peasant-like folk tied closely to the land and to their neighbors, unquote. That is, people like the Nazi philosopher Rosenberg, who favored the rural areas and peasant stocks over cities. Cities filled with Jews and the vices Jews used to pander to naive, gullible, inexperienced goyim. This leads Coburn to suspect that both the SPLC and the ADL, which helped fuel the FBI's Y2K predictions, are hauling water for the FBI, essentially acting as subcontractors performing tasks of defamation that in the old COINTELPRO days would have been performed by the Bureau itself. So the left-wing writer, Alexander Coburn, is saying that the FBI is farming out its suppression and thought control to the SPLC and the ADL. The government now allows people who claim to be the heirs of the civil rights movement to continue the disruption of Catholic communities, which began under people like Lewis Wirth at the OWI. I don't know what OWI is. That campaign would never have succeeded without the collaboration of Catholic quislings, people who were willing to denounce fellow Catholics to advance their careers. The more things change, the more they remain the same. Dennis Clark, Meet Victor Nakas, and Randall Ott. And we're getting near the end here. Very interesting stuff. And Jones, in his magazine, he has very few ads. He has one or two very long features each issue, and then a number of shorter reviews, and then a lot of letters. And that makes for a great magazine. And I recommend you subscribe at culturewars.com, even though Jones is not a white nationalist and would speak against some of what I'm saying. He still sees the SPLC and the ADL for what they are. He just doesn't understand the true nature of the Jew. He knows what we believe about the Jew. He just rejects it and has his own interpretation. And what he has in his long feature articles are large photographs of the people that he's talking about, like Nakas or Antonella Barba, who I'd never heard of before reading this. I guess she's some kind of American Idol contestant. She has large breasts. Diogenes at CWNews.com off the record raised the issue of who controls Catholic colleges and universities. And basically the Jews are trying to assert they will define everyone else, and you aren't allowed to define yourself. Whether you're a white nationalist or a Catholic, they will define your doctrine and your people for you and to you. Diogenes, who's some net writer, says, in San Antonio, the devout Catholics complained to the Archbishop when St. Mary's University hosted a campaign rally for Senator Hillary Clinton. Clinton's support for abortion, same-sex marriage, and embryonic stem cell research are a matter of public record, they pointed out. The Archbishop was sympathetic. The university was not. The rally went ahead on schedule. St. Louis University basketball coach Rick Majerus appeared at another Clinton rally and put his own support for abortion on the record. I might say parenthetically and as a side note, we talked about sports earlier. Rick Majerus is very, very popular, big, fat, roly-poly, Lithuanian-descended Catholic from the Midwest who coached out in Utah for a number of years, and his team would often be featured on ESPN's late-night basketball broadcast. They would typically do three games on a Monday and then two or three the other days of the week in basketball season, and often they would feature Utah, and it can't be any coincidence that, apart from the fact he's very personable and friendly, Rick Majerus is a liberal Catholic. And so that ties in with the political agenda of the Jews, and is probably one of the reasons they featured Utah so often. He's also a good coach, and they had a very good team. But it doesn't hurt at all that he's very liberal and in line with the Jews on the political stuff, and a big fan and crowd favorite. So St. Louis and Majerus had heart problems and retired, and then I think he recently came back in the last couple of years and now coaches at SLU, St. Louis University, which is a Catholic college, even though, and he's hired and paid a bunch of money, even though he supports anti-Catholic positions like abortion and Hillary Clinton. Rick Majerus appeared at another Clinton rally and put his own support for abortion on the record. Devout Catholics were scandalized. The Archbishop was appalled, but the Jesuit-run university said it was no big deal. Majerus was entitled to his own views. So it's interesting that in Washington this week, and again, this is some blog writer, some Catholic blog writer on the net. So it's interesting that in Washington this week, Catholic University stepped in to squash an entire lecture series because some speakers, quote, appear to espouse views that are contrary to the mission and values of Catholic University. So it's the usual double standard. Whatever promotes the going line as set by organized Jews is good. Whatever opposes it is bad. What prompted such a decisive response? The speakers scheduled to appear at Catholic U were E. Michael Jones, editor of Culture Wars magazine, and John Sharp, founder of IHS Press. Both are Catholics, admittedly of a controversial stripe, but Catholics nonetheless. So what was the complaint against them? The Southern Poverty Law Center, a leftist group that has often criticized Catholics, charges that Jones and Sharp are quote-unquote raging anti-Semites. A spokesman for the group claimed, quote, a simple Google search will show you the frightening ideology of these men, unquote. Go ahead, says the blogger named Diogenes. Go ahead, try the Google search. And I guess Diogenes is at cwnews.com. Try the Google search. Are you convinced? Do you see compelling evidence of anti-Semitism? Anything as clear as Hillary Clinton's voting record? The question here is not whether you and I agree with Jones and Sharp, but whether their views are demonstrably at odds with the teachings of the Catholic Church. When you're finished with that question, ask yourself why it is that officials at Catholic University will ignore the plaintive cries of the Catholic laity, but leap to respond to a left-wing pressure group. Says Jones again. Responding to Diogenes' post, Gill wrote, quote, as you know perfectly well, Di, the answer to your final question lies in the adjective describing the pressure group. I did Google E. Michael Jones, and in 20 minutes of searching found nothing to support a charge of anti-Semitism. Though there was a letter from somebody who did sound a trifle anti-Semitic criticizing Jones for not getting into bed with him. I paraphrase. A search for Catholic on the SPLC's website does turn up numerous articles attacking conservative Catholics. To which Brian Kopp added, no one who defends traditional Catholic theology is now safe from the spurious charge of anti-Semitism. Which is quite right. 1 week after the lecture series was canceled at Catholic University, Tim Allen found a home for the series at the Ukrainian Catholic National Shrine of the Holy Family, 4250 Harewood Road, Northeast, not far from the original location. So maybe some CUA architecture students will get to attend the lecture series after all. Who knows, maybe Antonella Barba will show up too. If she does, maybe Tim Allen can persuade her to teach Professors Ott and Nakus how to run a search engine. And with that concludes E. Michael Jones' story about the canceling of the lecture series. And a few more thoughts and we'll end here for today. We've gone a good, a little more than 3.5 hours. I've certainly enjoyed talking to you about these things. I have a suspicion, maybe it's because I've read these articles over and over. I can't remember if I've talked to them before, and I've only listened to one of my recent shows as a whole, so sometimes we may be going over the same material, but you know what? It's all good material, and it's all worth going over more than once, and I'm sure I'm making a lot of the same points, but maybe in a slightly different way. But great magazine. We learn a lot from it, as we learn from the books. I have talked too long today to go any further into Alfred Rosenberg and the Nordification of Christianity that he sought, the Germanic folk soul and the Germans living as Germans without being influenced by Jews. But we will cover that in other shows, and I have talked about it to a good extent today and woven it into what we've been discussing in relation to Jones, because we not only want to point out that we have common enemies with the Catholic, we want to point out where we and the Catholics differ, because it's very much to the advantage of those of us who are called Nazis or white nationalists, though I don't even take either title particularly. We're whites who want to live as whites more than anything, white normalists more than anything. It's very much to our advantage to point out where we differ from the Catholics, because the Catholic views are so manifestly insane. And by insanity to me is someone who insists on his will. Here's the irony of it. They're so anti-pride. It's E. Michael Jones's pride that prevents him from seeing that whites, blacks, and Jews belong to different species that are immiscible. They can only be mixed at gunpoint, and it does great harm to at least two out of the three. Of course, the Jews want to be mixed with us. They want to live separately among us and ride herd over us because it's good for them, but it's good for whites not to be mixed with Jews. And it's pride in his church, excessive pride in his church, and excessive pride in its dogmas that prevents him from seeing the simple biological truth that you cannot change the nature of a nigger or a Jew by sprinkling holy water on them. And so, just as Jones honestly and honorably points out the difference, well, I'll take that back. It's not wholly honorably. It's somewhat dishonestly, because, and this is the beauty of it, the more I learn from Jones, the better I am able to eat him. And soon enough, I'm going to be able to gobble him whole. I don't know quite all of what I need to know, but I know the basic outline of it. And he's really strung up, and legitimately and honestly, no smears involved, in a purely Aryan way, he's legitimately strung up by his absolutely uncritical use of the term racism and anti-Semitism, words that he would never use because they're pure Jewish agitprop and they have no objective meaning. Now, they have a meaning, but it's not a meaning in the sense that an ordinary word has a meaning. They have a meaning in the sense of they're an attack. They don't have a normal verb. I'm not sure the right way to put this. An ordinary word is intended to convey something about the world, and thus to be used as other words are, where appropriate. Terms like anti-Semitism and racism are not meant to mean anything. They're meant to signify that the person so described is to be attacked on a sliding scale from mocking to being murdered. And to the extent that you play along with the Jews pretending that these words have an actual or real meaning, you are thereby acceding to him and giving him a huge, truly an insuperable, that is an unovercomable advantage when you use his terms. So you must never use those terms except to explain what they mean to your fellow whites who are under attack. You must never see them any validity whatsoever, for they have none. They must be seen for what they are, the instruments of assault. Racist, anti-Semite, these are not adjectives flung at you. They are javelins flung through you, spears. The Jews and the homosexuals and the pederasts at the SBOC are attempting to broach you on their spear. Just to turn a little Shakespeare from, I believe, Titus Andronicus. Well, I'll broach the tadpole on me spear. Not a big Shakespeare fan, but a good line's a good line, and that one's irresistible, huh? And so, I'll leave you today with, I think we've had a lot of thoughts. We've covered a pretty wide ground here. Hopefully it's been entertaining and instructive. I listen to some radio around there. There's people I like. I listen to Bill Simmons' podcast. I listen to the Adam Carolla Show. If you want, most mainstream stuff I don't like at all. Adam Carolla Show, if you Google it, I'll post some links to this sometime. Sometimes he has some interesting views, some normal white guy views on stuff that's pretty good, and it makes me wonder if he reads around and listens to other stuff on the net, despite having a busy life. But for mainstream stuff, he has a couple of decent podcasts. E. Michael Jones every now and then has a podcast I like to listen to. I know he has one printed interview and one recent podcast he's done with his people over at Culture Wars, in which he discusses the Jewish revolutionary spirit, which we have discussed a few chapters of here on Radio Astina, and we'll discuss more as I complete it. I'm a little distracted with reading about the Nordicizing of Christianity in Rosenberg right now, but we will get back to that. Anyway, my name is Alex Linder. If you're new and listening to this, I've been doing Vanguard News Network for about 10 years. Daily news and information on the web. We have a forum at vnnforum.com. We encourage you to join if you're a serious person. Don't be misled by the anti's claim we're a bunch of evil Nazis and haters and what have you. Normal, intelligent men who can accept reality without the blinders. We can look at what's actually going on and give you the truth. And that's captured and summed up by my words here on Radio Astina and the very title of the show, which means the factual truth in the matter, which we are strong enough to look at directly. We don't have to believe in normal lies. We don't have to allow ourselves to be converted into foul cultists, believing in the liberal lie of equality and democracy and the rest of the garbage. Ours is the path of honor and nobility and the truth. And that's the way of the Aryan. That's what we are. And that's what you are listening to this, whether you realize it or not. And I want to thank you for being with me today. On October 28th, Tuesday, year of our Lord, 2008, we will be with you again next Tuesday. And I guess, my gosh, that will pretty much be the day of the election. And it may well be that we have the first nigger president in America's history, J.F. Kenyon, the new Messiah. I'm not looking forward to it any more than you are. But I think that'll do it for today. And again, thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week. Good night.